She started upstream, trying not to think about the men who had touched and sneered in that cell. But if it got her safely across the river, she'd use her body to her advantage. Men would see what they wanted to. A pretty young woman who did not bristle at their attention, who spoke kindly and warmly. Someone trustworthy. Someone sweet yet unremarkable. Lorcan trailed, then caught up to walk beside her like an actual companion and not some promise-bound escort for the final half mile around the bend of the river. Horses and wagons and shouts greeted them before the sight did. But there it was, a broad if worn stone bridge, wagons and carts and riders lined up in droves on either side, and about 2 dozen guards in Otterlanian colors, monitoring either bank, collecting tolls, and checking wagons, inspecting every face and person. The Ilkin had known about her limp. Elide slowed, keeping close to Lorcan as they neared the 2-story derelict barracks on their side of the river. Down the road, flanked by the trees, a few equally sorry-looking buildings were a flurry of activity, an inn and a tavern, for travelers to wait out the lines with a drink or meal, or perhaps rent a room during inclement weather. So many people. Humans. No one appeared panicked or hurt or sickly. And the guards, despite their uniforms, moved like men while they searched the wagons passing the barracks that served as toll house and sleeping quarters. She said quietly to Lorcan as they headed for the dirt road and the distant back of the line, "I don't know what magic you possess, but if you can make my limp less noticeable." Before she could finish, a force like a cool night wind pushed against her ankle and calf, then wrapped around it in a solid grip. A brace. Her steps evened out, and she had to bite back her urge to gawk at the feeling of walking straight and sure. She didn't allow herself to enjoy it, savor it, not when it would likely only last until they cleared the bridge. Merchants' wagons idled, crammed with goods from those who hadn't wanted to risk the Avery River to the north, their drivers tight-faced at the wait and impending inspections. Elide scanned the drivers, the merchants, the other travelers. Each one of them made her instincts shout that they'd be betrayed the second they asked to ride or offered a coin to keep quiet. To troll the line would catch the eye of the guards, so Elide used every step to study it while seemingly heading toward the back. But she reached the end of the line empty-handed. Lorcan, however, gave a pointed glance behind her, toward the tavern, whitewashed to no doubt hide the near-crumbling stones.
"Let's get a bite before we wait," he said,
loud enough for the wagon in front of them to hear and dismiss it. She nodded. Someone else might be inside, and her stomach was grumbling. Except, "I don't have any money," she murmured as they approached the pale wooden door. Lie. She had gold and silver from Manon, but she wasn't about to flash it in front of Lorcan, promise or no.
"I've got plenty," he said tightly,
and she delicately cleared her throat. He lifted his brows.
"You'll win us no allies looking like that," she said,
and gave him a sweet little smile.
"Walk in there looking like a warrior, and you'll get noticed."
"And what am I to be, then?"
"Whatever we need you to be when the time comes. But don't glower."
He opened the door, and by the time her eyes adjusted to the glow of the wrought iron chandeliers, Lorcan's face had changed. His eyes might never be warm, but a bland smile was on his face, his shoulders relaxed, as if he were slightly inconvenienced by the wait but eager for a good meal. He almost looked human. The tavern was packed, the noise so deafening that she could barely speak loudly enough to the nearest barmaid to order lunch. They squeezed between cramped tables, and Elide noticed that more than a few pairs of eyes went to her chest, then her face, and lingered. She pushed against the crawling feeling and kept her steps unhurried as she aimed for a table tucked against the back wall that a weary-looking couple had just vacated. A boisterous party of eight was crammed around the table a few feet away, a middle-aged woman with a booming laugh instantly singling herself out as their leader. The others at the table, a beautiful raven-haired woman, a barrel-chested bearded man whose hands were as large as dinner plates, and a few rough-looking people, all kept looking to the older woman, gauging her responses and listening carefully to what she had to say. Elide slid into the worn wooden chair, Lorkin claiming the one across from her, his size earning him a look from the bearded man and the middle-aged woman at the table. Elide weighed that look. Assessment. Not for a fight, not for a threat, but in appreciation and calculation. Elide wondered for a heartbeat if Aneth herself had nudged that other couple to move away, to free up this one table for them, for that very look. Elide laid her hand out on the table, palm up, and gave Lorkin a sleepy smile she'd once seen a kitchen maid give a Morath cook. "Husband," she said sweetly, wriggling her fingers. Lorkin's mouth tightened, but he took her hand, her fingers dwarfed in his. His calluses scraped against her own. He noticed it at the same moment she did, sliding his hand to cup hers so he might inspect her palm. She closed her hand, rotating it to grip his again.
"Brother," Lorkin murmured so no one else could hear. "I am your brother."
"You are my husband," she said with equal quiet. "We have been married 3 months. Follow my lead."
He glanced around, not having noticed the assessing stare they'd been given. Doubt still danced in his eyes, along with a silent question. She said simply,
"Men will not fear the threat of a brother. I would still be unclaimed, still be open for invitations. I have seen how little respect men have for anything they think they are entitled to. So you are my husband," she hissed, "until I say otherwise."
A shadow flickered in Lorkin's eyes, along with another question, one she didn't want to and couldn't answer. His hand tightened on hers, demanding she look at him. She refused. Their food arrived, mercifully, before Lorkin could ask it. Stew, root vegetables and rabbit. She dug in, nearly melting the roof of her mouth at the first bite. The group behind them began talking again, and she listened as she ate, selecting bits and pieces as if they were shells on a shore.
"Maybe we'll offer them a performance, and they'll cut the toll fee in half,"
from the blonde, bearded man. "Unlikely," the leader said. "Those pricks would charge us to perform. Worse, they enjoy our performance and demand we stay a while. We can't afford that wait, not when other companies are already on the move. We don't want to hit all the plains towns after everyone else."
Elide almost choked on her stew. Aneth must have freed this table then. Her plan had been to find a trooper carnival to fall into, disguise themselves as workers, and this. "We pay full price on that toll," the beautiful woman said, "and we might get to that first town half-starved and barely able to perform at all."
Elide lifted her eyes to Lorkin's. He gave a nod. She took a sip of her stew, steeling herself, thinking of Asterin Blackbeak. Charming, confident, fearless. She'd always had her head at a jaunty angle, a looseness to her limbs, a hint of a smile on her lips. Elide took a breath, letting those memories sink into muscle and flesh and bone. Then she pivoted in her chair, an arm draped around the back, as she leaned toward their table and said with a grin,
"Sorry to interrupt your meal, but I couldn't help but overhear your conversation."
They all turned toward her, brows high, the eyes of the leader going right to Elide's face. She saw the assessment. Young, pretty, unblemished by a hard life. Elide kept her own expression pleasant, willed her eyes to brighten.
Are you some sort of performing troupe?
She motioned to Lorcan with a tilt of her head.
My husband and I have been looking to fall in with one for weeks, with no luck. Everyone's full.
So are we, their leader said.
Right, Elide replied merrily. But that toll is steep, for anyone. And if we were to be in business together, perhaps on a temporary basis...
Lorcan's knee brushed hers in warning. She ignored him.
We'd be glad to chip in on the fee. Make up any difference owed.
The woman's assessment turned wary. We are a carnival indeed, but we have no need of new members. The bearded man and beautiful woman shot glances at the woman, reprimand in their eyes. Elide shrugged.
All right, then. But in case you change your mind before you depart, my husband,
a gesture to Lorcan, who was giving his best attempt at an easy smile,
is an expert sword thrower, and in our previous troop, he made good coin matching himself against men who sought to best him in feats of strength.
The leader turned her keen eyes on Lorcan, on the height and muscles and posture. Elide knew she'd guessed right on the vacancy they'd needed filled when the woman said to her, And what did you do for them?
I worked as a fortune teller. They called me their oracle.
A shrug.
Mostly just shadows and guesswork.
It'd have to be, considering the little fact that she couldn't read. The woman remained unimpressed. And what was your troop's name?
They likely knew them, knew every troop that patrolled the plains.
She scanned her memory for anything helpful,
anything.
Yellowlegs. The witches in Morath had once mentioned Baba Yellowlegs, who had traveled in a carnival to avoid detection, who had died in Rifthold this winter with no explanation. Detail after detail, buried in the catacombs of her memory, poured out.
We were in the Carnival of Mirrors, Elide said.
Recognition, surprise, respect sparked in the leader's eyes.
Until Baba Yellowlegs, our owner, was killed in Rifthold this past winter. We left, and have been looking for work since.
Where did you come from, then?
The bearded man asked. It was Lorcan who replied.
My family lives on the western side of the Fangs. We've spent the past few months with them, waited until the snows melted, since the pass was so treacherous. Strange things happening, he added, in the mountains these days.
The company stilled.
Indeed,
the raven-haired woman said. She looked to their leader.
They could help pay the toll, Molly. And since Saul left, that act has been empty.
Likely their sword thrower.
Like I said, Elide chimed in with Asterin's pretty smile. We'll be here for a little while, so if you change your minds, let us know. If not,
she saluted with her dented spoon.
Safe travels.
Something flashed in Molly's eyes, but the woman looked them over once more.
Safe travels, she murmured.
Elide and Lorcan returned to their meal. And when the barmaid came to take their money for it, Elide reached into her inner pocket and pulled out a silver coin. The barmaid's eyes were wide, but it was the sharp eyes of Molly, of the others at that table, that Elide noted, as the girl slipped away and brought back their change. Lorcan kept silent as Elide left a generous tip on the table, but they both offered pleasant smiles to the troop as they vacated their table and the tavern. Elide went right to the back of the line, still keeping that smile on her face, her back straight. Lorcan sidled up close,
not at all noteworthy for the front they were putting on.
You have no money, do you?
She gave him a sidelong glance.
Looks like I was mistaken.
A flash of white teeth as he smiled, genuinely this time.
Well, you'd better hope you and I have enough, Marion, because Molly's about to make you an offer.
Elide turned at the crunch of dirt beneath black boots and found Molly before them, the others lingering, some slipping around the corner of the tavern to no doubt retrieve the wagons. Molly's hard face was flushed, as if they'd been arguing. But she just clicked her tongue and said,
Temporary stint. If you're shit, you're out. And we won't pay back the money for the toll.
Elide smiled, not entirely faking it.
Marion and Lorcan, at your service, madam.
His wife. Gods above. He was over 500 years old, and this girl, young woman, she-devil, whatever she was, had just bluffed and lied her way into a job. A sword thrower indeed. Lorcan lingered outside the tavern, Marion at his side. A small troop, hence the lack of funds, and one that had seen better days, he realized, as the two yellow-painted wagons clattered and wobbled into view, pulled by four nags. Marion carefully observed Molly climb into the driver's seat beside the raven-haired beauty, who paid Lorcan absolutely no heed.
Well, having Marion as his god's damned wife certainly put an end to anything more than appreciation of the stunning woman. It was an effort not to growl. He hadn't been with a woman in months now. And of course he'd have the time and interest in one, only to be shackled by another one's lies. His wife.
Not that Marion was hard on the eyes, he noted, as she obeyed Molly's barked order to climb into the back of the second wagon. Some of the other party members followed on piss-poor horses. Marion took the bearded man's extended hand, and he easily hauled her into the wagon. Lorcan trailed, assessing everyone in the party, everyone in the makeshift little town. A number of men, and some women, had noticed Marion when she strode by. The sweet face paired with sinful curves, and without the limp, with her hair out of her face. She knew exactly what she was doing. Knew people would notice those things, think about those things, instead of the cunning mind and lies she fed them. Lorcan ignored the hand the bearded man offered, and jumped into the back of the wagon, reminding himself to sit close to Marion, to put an arm around her bony shoulders, and look relieved and happy to have a troop again. Supplies filled the wagon, along with five other people who all smiled at Marion, and then quickly looked away from him. Marion put a hand on his knee, and Lorcan avoided the urge to flinch. It had been a shock earlier, to feel how rough those delicate hands were. Not just a prisoner in Morath, but a slave. The calluses were old and dense enough that she'd likely worked for years. Hard labor from the looks of it. And with that ruined leg. He tried not to think about that tang of fear and pain he'd sensed when she told him how little she believed in the kindness and decency of men. He didn't let his imagination delve too deep regarding why she might feel that way. The wagon was hot, the air soaked with human sweat, hay, the shit of the horses lined up before them, the tang of iron from the weapons.
Not much by way of belongings? Asked the bearded man.
Nick, he'd called himself. Shit. He'd forgotten humans traveled with baggage as if they were moving somewhere.
We lost most of it on our trip out of the mountains. My husband, Marion said with charming annoyance, insisted we ford a rushing stream. I'm lucky he even bothered to help me out, since he certainly didn't go after our supplies.
A low chuckle from Nick. I suspect he was more focused on saving you than on the packs.
Marion rolled her eyes, patting Lorkin's knee. He nearly cringed at every touch. Even with his lovers, outside the bed itself, he didn't like casual, careless contact. Some found that intolerable. Some thought they could break him into a decent male who just wanted a home and a good female to work beside him. Not one of them had succeeded. I can save myself, Marion said brightly. But his throwing swords, our cooking supplies, my clothes.
A shake of the head.
His act might be a bit lackluster until we can find somewhere to purchase more supplies.
Nick met Lorkin's eyes, holding them for longer than most men dared. What he did for the carnival, Lorkin wasn't sure. Sometime performer, but definitely security.
Nick's smile faded a bit.
The land beyond the fangs isn't kind. Your people must be hardy folk to live out there.
Lorkin nodded.
A rougher life, he said, than I want for my wife. Life on the road isn't much better, Nick countered.
Ah, Marion chimed in. But isn't it? A life of open skies and roads, of wandering where the wind takes you, answering to no one and nothing. A life of freedom.
She shook her head.
What more could I ask than to live a life unchecked by cages?
Lorkin knew the words were no lie. He had seen her face when they beheld the grassy plain.
Spoken like someone who has spent long enough on the road, Nick said. It always goes either way with our kind. You settle down and never travel again, or you wander forever.
I want to see life, see the world, Marion said, her voice softening. I want to see everything.
Lorkin wondered if Marion would even get to do that if he failed in his task, if the word key he carried wound up in the wrong hands.
Best not wander too far, Nick said, frowning. Not with what happened in Rifthold, or what's brewing down in Morath. What happened in Rifthold?
Lorkin cut in, sharply enough that Marion squeezed his knee. Nick idly scratched his wheat-colored beard.
Whole city's been sacked. Overrun, they say, by flying terrors and demon women as their riders. Witches, if one is to believe the rumors. Iron Teeth, straight out of legend.
A shudder. Holy gods.
The destruction would have been a sight to behold. Lorkin forced himself to listen, to concentrate, and not begin calculating casualties and what it would mean for this war, as Nick continued.
No word on the young king, but the city belongs to the witches and their beasts. They say to travel north is to now face a death trap. To travel south is another death trap. So,
a shrug,
we'll head east. Maybe we can find a way to bypass whatever's waiting in either direction. Maybe war will come and we'll all scatter to the winds.
Nick looked him over.
Men like you and me might be conscripted.
Lorkin bit back a dark chuckle. No one could force him into anything, save for one person, and she...
His chest tightened. It was best not to think of his queen. You think either side would do that? Force men to fight?
Marion's words were breathless.
Don't know,
Nick said, the scent and sound of the river now overwhelming enough that Lorkin knew they were near the toll. He reached into his jacket for the money Molly had demanded. Far more than their fair share, but he didn't care. These people could go to hell the moment they were safely hidden deep in the endless plains.
Duke Parrington's forces might not even want us, if they've got witches and beasts on their side.
And much worse, Lorcan wanted to say. Wordhounds and Ilkin and the gods knew what.
But Aelin Galathinius?
Nick mused. Marian's hand went limp on Lorcan's knee.
Who knows what she will do? She has not called for aid, has not asked soldiers to come to her. Yet she held Rifthold in her grip, killed the king, destroyed his castle, but gave the city back.
The bench beneath them groaned as Marian leaned forward.
What do you know of Aelin?
Rumors, here and there,
Nick said, shrugging.
They say she's beautiful as sin, and colder than ice. They say she's a tyrant, a coward, a whore. They say she's God's blessed or God's damned. Who knows? 19 seems awfully young to have such burdens. Rumor claims her cord is strong, though. A shapeshifter guards her back, and two warrior princes flank her on either side.
Lorcan thought of that shapeshifter, who had so unceremoniously vomited not once, but twice all over him. Thought of those two warrior princes, one of them Gavriel's son.
Will she save or damn us all?
Nick considered, now monitoring the snaking line behind their wagon.
I don't know if I much like the thought of everything resting in her hands. But if she wins, perhaps the land will get better. Life will get better. And if she fails, perhaps we all deserve to be damned anyway.
She will win, Marian said with quiet strength.
Nick's brows rose. Men shouted, and Lorcan said,
I'd save talk of her for another time.
Boots crunched, and then uniformed men were peering into the back of the wagon.
Out,
one ordered.
Line up.
The man's eyes snagged on Marian. Lorcan's arm tightened around her, as an ugly, too familiar light filled the soldier's eyes. Lorcan bit back his snarl as he said to her,
Come, wife.
The soldier noticed him then. The man backed away a step, a bit pale, then ordered the supplies be searched. Lorcan jumped out first, bracing his hands on Marian's waist as he helped her off the wagon. When she made a step away, he tugged her back against him, an arm across her abdomen. He met each soldier's stare as they passed and wondered who was looking after the dark-haired beauty in the front. A moment later, she and Molly came around. A dark rimmed hat was slung over the beauty's head, half of her light brown face obscured, her body concealed in a heavy coat that drew the eye away from any feminine curves. Even the cast of her mouth was unpleasant, as if the woman had slipped into another person's skin entirely. Still, Molly nudged the woman between Lorcan and Nick, then took the money pouch from Lorcan's free hand without so much as a thank you. The dark-haired beauty leaned forward to murmur to Marian,
Don't look them in the eye, and don't talk back.
Marian nodded, chin dipping as she focused on the ground. Against him, he could feel her racing heart, wild, despite the calm submission written over every line of her body.
And you?
The beauty hissed at him, as the soldiers searched their wares and took what they wanted.
Molly says if you get into a fight, you're gone, and we're not bailing you out of prison. So let them talk and laugh, but don't interfere.
Lorcan debated saying he could slaughter this entire garrison if he pleased, but nodded. After 5 minutes, another order was shouted. Molly handed over Lorcan's money and her own to pay the toll, plus more for expedited passage. Then they were all back in the wagon again, none of them daring to see what had been pilfered. Marian was shaking slightly against where he kept her tucked into his side. But her face was blank, bored. The guards hadn't so much as questioned them, hadn't asked after a woman with a limp. The acanthus roared beneath them as they crossed the bridge,
wagon wheels clattering on ancient stones. Marion kept shaking. Lorcan studied her face again, the hint of red along her high cheekbones, her tight mouth. Not shaking from fear, he realized, as he caught a whiff of her scent. A slight tang of it, perhaps, but mostly something red-hot, something wild and raging and anger. It was boiling rage that made her shake, at the inspection, at the leering of the guards. An idealist. That's what Marion was. Someone who wanted to fight for her queen, who believed, as Nick did, that this world could be better. As they cleared the other side of the bridge, the soldiers letting them pass without fuss, as they meandered past the line on that side and emerged onto the plains themselves, Lorcan wondered at that anger, at that belief in a better world. He didn't feel like telling either Marion or Nick that their dream was a fool's one. Marion relaxed enough to peer out the back of the wagon, at the grasses flanking the wide dirt road, at the blue sky, at the roaring river and the looming sprawl of Oakwald behind them. And for all her rage, a tentative sort of wonder grew in her dark eyes. He ignored it. Lorcan had seen the worst and best in men for 500 years. There was no such thing as a better world, no such thing as a happy end, because there were no endings. And there would be nothing waiting for them in this war. Nothing waiting for an escaped slave girl, but a shallow grave. Chapter 20. Rowan Whitethorn just needed a place to rest. He didn't give a shit if it was a bed, or a pile of hay, or even beneath a horse in a stable. As long as it was quiet, and there was a roof to keep out the driving veils of rain, he didn't care. Skull's Bay was what he expected, and yet not. Ramshackle buildings, painted every color but mostly in cracking disrepair, were bustling, as residents shuttered windows and hauled in clotheslines against the storm that had chased Rowan and Dorian into the harbor minutes ago. Hooded and cloaked, no one had asked them any questions once Rowan had flipped a 5 copper mark to the dockmaster. Enough to keep his mouth shut, but not enough to warrant any of the would-be thieves monitoring the docks to come after them. Dorian had mentioned twice now that he wasn't sure how Rowan was still functioning. To be honest, Rowan wasn't either. He'd allowed himself to doze only for hours at a time over the past few days. The burnout loomed, steadily fraying his grip on his magic, his focus. When Rowan hadn't been wrangling the winds to propel their skiff through the vibrant warm waters of the Dead Islands archipelago, he'd been soaring high above to monitor for approaching enemies. He'd seen none, just turquoise ocean and white sands flecked with dark volcanic stone, all of it ringing the dense emerald foliage crusting mountainous islands that spread as far as even a hawk's eye could see. Thunder grumbled across Skull's Bay, and the turquoise sea beyond the harbor seemed to glow brighter, as if a distant lightning strike had lit up the entire ocean. Along the docks, a cobalt-painted tavern remained lightly guarded, even with the storm bearing down on them. The Sea Dragon. Rolf's own headquarters, named after his ship, from Aelin's reports. Rowan debated going right up to it, no more than 2 lost travelers seeking shelter from the storm. But he and the young king had chosen another route during the many hours he'd made good on his promise to teach Dorian about magic. They'd worked for only minutes at a time, since it'd be no use if the king wrecked their little boat should his power slip its leash. So it had been exercises with ice, summoning a ball of frost to his palm, letting it melt, over and over. Even now, standing like a stone amid the stream of people hauling in wares from the storm's fury, The king was curling and relaxing his fingers, letting Rowan glean their bearings while he gazed across the horseshoe-shaped bay to the colossal chain stretched across its mouth, currently beneath the surface. Shipbreaker, the chain was called. Crusted with barnacles and draped in scarves of seaweed, it was connected to a watchtower on either side of the bay, where guards would raise and lower the chain to let ships out, or keep ships in until they'd paid the hefty tolls. They'd been lucky that the chain had already been lowered in anticipation of the storm. Since their plan for announcing themselves would be calm, diplomatic. Which it would need to be, given that the last time Aelin had set foot in Skull's Bay, 2 years ago, she'd wrecked that chain and taken out one of the now rebuilt watchtowers. Rolf, it seemed, had added a sister tower across the bay since then, plus half the town, and disabled the rudders on every ship in the harbor, including Rolf's prized one, the Sea Dragon. Rowan wasn't surprised, but seeing the scope of the hell she had unleashed, holy gods. So Dorian's announcement of his arrival would be the opposite of that. They'd take rooms at a reputable inn and then request an audience with Rolf, proper and dignified. Lightning flashed, and Rowan swiftly scanned the street ahead, a hand gripping his hood to keep the wind from revealing his fey heritage. An emerald-painted inn lay at the other end of the block, its gilded sign clacking in the wild wind. The Ocean Rose. The nicest inn in town, the dockmaster had claimed when they asked, since they at least needed to appear like they could make good on the money they'd offer Rolf. And get some rest, if only for a few hours. Rowan stepped toward it, nearly sagging with relief, and looked over a shoulder to motion the king to follow. But as if the gods themselves wanted to test him, a gust of rain-cooled wind sprayed into their faces, and some sense pricked in its wake. A shift in the air, like a great pocket of power gathered close, beckoning. The knife at his side was instantly in his soaked hand as he searched the rooftops, revealing only plumes of rain. Rowan quieted his mind, listening to the city and storm around them. Dorian swept his dripping hair out of his face, mouth open to speak, until he noted the knife.
You feel it too.
Rowan nodded, rain sliding down his nose.
What do you sense?
The king's raw power might pick up different feelings, different clues, than what his wind and ice and instinct could detect. But without the training, it might not be clear.
It feels old,
Dorian winced and said over the storm.
Feral, ruthless. I can't glean anything more.
Does it remind you of the Vogue?
If there was one person who'd know, it'd be the king before him.
No,
Dorian said, gaze shuddering.
They were abhorrent to my magic. This thing out there, it just makes my magic curious. Wary, but curious. But it's concealed. Somehow.
Rowan sheathed his knife.
Then stay close, and keep alert.
Dorian had never been in such a place as Skull's Bay. Even with the heavy rain lashing them, as they hunted the source of that power down the main street, he'd marveled at the blend of lawlessness and complete order of the island city. It bowed to no king of royal blood, yet was ruled by a pirate lord who had clawed his way to power, thanks to hands tattooed with a map of the world's oceans. A map, rumor claimed, that had revealed where enemies, treasure, and storms awaited him. The cost? His eternal soul. Aelin had once confirmed that Rolf was indeed soulless and indeed tattooed. As for the map, she'd shrugged, saying Rolf claimed it stopped moving when magic fell. Dorian wondered if that map now indicated that he and Rowan walked through his city, if it marked them as enemies. Perhaps Aelin's arrival would be known well before she set foot on this island. Cloaked and hooded and thoroughly soaked, Dorian and Rowan made a wide circuit of the surrounding streets. People had quickly vanished, and the ships in the harbor rocked wildly with the waves lapping over the broad quay and onto the cobblestones. Palms thrashed and hissed, and not even gulls stirred. His magic remained dormant, rumbling when he'd stiffen at a loud noise from within the taverns, inns, homes, and shops they passed. At his side, Rowan plowed through the storm, the rain and wind seeming to part for him. They reached the quay, Rolf's massive prize ship looming out in the heaving waters, sails tied down against the storm. At least Rolf was here. At least that had gone right. Dorian was so busy observing the ship that he nearly slammed into Rowan's back as the warrior prince halted. He staggered back, Rowan mercifully not commenting on it, then scanned the building that had snagged the prince's attention. His magic perked up like a startled deer.
"I shouldn't even be surprised," Rowan grumbled,
and the blue-painted sign clattered in the winds above the tavern entrance. The Sea Dragon. Two guards stood halfway down the block. Guards not for any uniform, but for the fact that they were standing in this storm, hands on their swords. Rowan angled his head, in a way that told Dorian the prince was likely contemplating whether it was worth it to chuck the men into the roiling harbor. But no one stopped them, as Rowan gave Dorian a warning look and opened the door to the pirate lord's personal tavern. Golden light, spices, polished wood floors and walls greeted them. It was empty, despite the storm. Utterly empty, save for the dozen or so tables. Rowan shut the door behind Dorian, scanning the room, the small stairs in the back. From where they stood, Dorian could see the letters covering most of the tables. Storm Chaser, Lady Anne, Tiger Star, the sterns of ships. Every table was made from them. They hadn't been taken from wrecks. No, this was a trophy room. A reminder to those who met with the pirate lord of how exactly he had gained his crown. All the tables seemed centered around one in the back, bigger and more worn than the others. Thresher. The enormous slats were flecked with burn marks and gouges, but the lettering remained clear, as if Rolf never wanted to forget what ship was used as his personal dining table. But as for the man himself and that power they'd felt, no sign of either. A door behind the bar opened, and a slim, brown-haired young woman stepped out. Her apron marked her as the barmaid, but her shoulders were back, head high, gray eyes sharp and clear as she scanned them and remained unimpressed.
"He was wondering when you two would come snooping," she said,
her accent rich and thick, like Adian's. Rowan said,
"Oh?"
The barmaid jerked her delicate chin toward the narrow wood stairs in the back.
"Captain wants to see you, in his office. One flight up, second door down."
"Why?"
Even Dorian knew not to ignore that tone. But the girl just grabbed a glass, held it to the candlelight to inspect for smudges, and pulled a rag from her apron. Twin tattoos of roaring gray sea dragons snaked around her tan forearms, the beast seeming to slither as her muscles shifted with the movement. Their scales, he realized, matched her eyes perfectly as she flicked her stare over Dorian and Rowan once more and said coolly,
"Don't keep him waiting."
Dorian murmured to Rowan as they ascended the creaky, dim stairs.
"It could be a trap."
"Possibly," Rowan said with equal quiet. "But consider that we were allowed to come to him. If it was a trap, the smarter move would have been to catch us unawares.
Dorian nodded, something in his chest easing.
And you, your magic is better? That hard face yielded nothing. I'll manage.
Not an answer. Along the second-level hallway, four steely-eyed young men had been stationed, each armed with fine swords whose hilts were fashioned after attacking sea dragons, surely the mark of their captain. None bothered to speak, as he and Rowan made for the indicated door. The Fey Prince knocked once. A grunt was all they got in response. Dorian didn't know what he expected from the Lord of Pirates. But a dark-haired man, a day past 30 if that, lounging on a red velvet chaise before the rain-splattered curve of windows, was not it. Chapter 21. The pirate lord of Skull's Bay did not turn from where he was sprawled on the chaise, piles of papers littering the worn cobalt rug beneath it. From the neat columns that Dorian could barely make out from where he and Rowan stood, a few feet into the man's office, the papers seemed crammed with tallies of goods or expenses, ill-gained or otherwise. But Rolf continued monitoring the ships tilting and bobbing in the harbor, the shadow of shipbreaker's sagging chain cleaving the storm-tossed world beyond them. Rolf had likely learned of their arrival not due to any magic map, but from sitting here. Indeed, dark leather gloves adorned his hands, the material scarred and cracked with age. Not a hint of the legendary tattoos lurking beneath. Rowan didn't move, barely blinked as he took in the captain, the office. Dorian himself had been part of enough political maneuverings to know the uses of silence, the power in who spoke first, the power in making someone wait. The rain drumming on the windows and the muffled dripping of their own soaked clothes on the threadbare carpet filled the quiet. Captain Rolf tapped a gloved finger on the arm of the chaise, watching the harbor for a heartbeat longer, as if to make sure the sea dragon still floated, and finally turned to them.
Take off your hoods. I want to know who I'm talking to.
Dorian stiffened at the command, but Rowan said,
Your barmaid implied that you know damn well who we are.
A wry half-smile tugged on Rolf's lips, the upper left corner flecked with a small scar, hopefully not from Aelin.
My barmaid talks too much.
Then why keep her?
Easy on the eyes. Hard to come by around here,
Rolf said, uncoiling to his feet. He was about Dorian's height and clothed in simple but well-made black. An elegant rapier hung at his side, along with a matching parrying knife. Rowan snorted, but to Dorian's surprise, removed his hood. Rolf's sea-green eyes flared, no doubt at the silver hair, pointed ears, and slightly elongated canines. Or the tattoo.
A man who likes ink as much as I do,
Rolf said with an appreciative nod.
I think you and I will get along just fine, Prince.
Male,
Rowan corrected.
Fey males are not human men.
Semantics,
Rolf said, flicking his attention to Dorian.
So you're the king everyone's in such a tizzy over.
Dorian finally tugged back his hood.
What of it?
With that gloved hand, Rolf pointed toward a paper-covered desk and two upholstered chairs before it. Like the man himself, it was elegant but worn, either from age, use, or battles past. And those gloves, to cover the maps inked there. Rowan gave Dorian a nod to sit.
The flames on the candles burning throughout guttered as they passed and claimed their seats. Rolf edged around the stacks of papers on the floor and took up his spot at the desk. His carved high-backed chair might very well have been a throne from some distant kingdom.
You seem remarkably calm for a king who's just been declared a traitor to his crown and robbed of his throne.
Dorian was glad he was in the process of sitting down. Rowan lifted a brow.
According to whom?
According to the messengers who arrived yesterday, Rolf said, leaning back in his seat and crossing his arms. Duke Parrington, or should I call him King Parrington now, issued a decree, signed by the majority of Arterland's lords and ladies, naming you, Majesty, an enemy to your kingdom, and claiming that he liberated Rifthold from your claws after you and the Queen of Terrasen slaughtered so many innocents this spring. It also claims that any ally, a nod toward Rowan, is an enemy, and that you will be crushed under his armies if you do not yield. Silence filled his head. Rolf went on, perhaps a bit more gently. Your brother has been named Parrington's heir and crown prince.
Oh, gods. Holland was a child, but still, something had rotted in him, festered. He had left them there. Rather than deal with his mother and brother, he'd told them to stay in those mountains, where they were now as good as lambs surrounded by a pack of wolves. He wished Kaol were with him, wished for time to just stop, so he might sort out all these fractured pieces of himself, put them into some kind of order, if not back together entirely. Rolf said,
from the look on your face, I'm guessing your arrival indeed has something to do with the fact that Rifthold now lies in ruin, its people fleeing wherever they can.
Dorian shoved out the insidious thoughts and drawled, I came to learn what side of the line you stand on, Captain, in regard to this conflict.
Rolf sat forward, resting his forearms on the desk. You must be desperate indeed, then. A glance at Rowan. And is your queen equally desperate for my aid?
My queen, Rowan said, is not a part of this discussion.
Rolf only grinned at Dorian.
You wish to know what side of the line I stand on. I stand on the side that keeps the hell out of my territory.
Rumor has it, Rowan countered smoothly, that the easternmost part of this archipelago is no longer your territory at all.
Rolf held Rowan's gaze. A heartbeat passed, then another. A muscle flickered in Rolf's jaw. Then he pulled off those gloves to reveal hands tattooed from fingertip to wrist. He turned them palm up, revealing a map of the archipelago. And what? Dorian and Rowan leaned forward, as the blue waters did indeed flow, little dots among it sailing by. And in the easternmost tip of the archipelago, curving out to sea, those waters were gray, the islands a ruddy brown. But nothing moved. No dots indicated ships, as if the map had frozen.
They have magic that shields them, even from this, Rolf said. I can't get a count of their ships, or men, or beasts. Scouts never return. This winter, we'd hear roaring from the islands, some almost human, some definitely not. Often we'd spy things standing out on those rocks. Men, but not. We let it go unchecked for too long, and paid the price.
Beasts, Dorian said. What sort of beasts?
A grim smile,
scar stretching. One's to make you consider fleeing this continent, Majesty. The condescension snapped something loose in Dorian's temper.
I have walked through more nightmares than you realize, Captain.
Rolf snorted, but his eyes went to that pale line across Dorian's throat. Rowan leaned back in his chair with lazy grace, the war commander incarnate.
It must be a solid truce you hold, then, if you're still camped here with minimal ships in your harbor.
Rolf simply tugged on his worn gloves. My fleet does have to do a little pirating every now and then, you know. Bills to pay and all that.
I'm sure, especially when you employ 4 guards to watch your hallway.
Dorian caught Rowan's train of thought and said to the Fey Prince,
I didn't send the Vog in town.
No, whatever that power had been, it had flickered into nothing now.
That's because, Rolf drawled, cutting them off. We killed most of them.
Wind rattled the windows, smearing the rain across the hall.
And as for the 4 men in the hall, they are all that's left of my crew, thanks to the battle we had early this spring to reclaim this island after Parrington's general stole it from us.
Dorian swore low and viciously. The captain nodded.
But I am again Pirate Lord of Skull's Bay, and if the Eastern Islands are as far as Morath plans to go, then Parrington and his beasts can have them. The Dead End is barely more than caves and rock anyway.
What manner of beasts?
Dorian said again. Rolf's pale green eyes darkened.
Sea wyverns.
Witches rule the skies with their wyverns, but these waters are now ruled by beasts bred for naval battle, foul corruptions of an ancient template.
Imagine a creature, half the size of a first-rate ship, faster than a racing dolphin, and the damage it can cause with tooth and claw and a poisoned tail big as a mast. Worse, if you kill one of their vicious offspring, the adults will hunt you to the ends of the earth.
Rolf shrugged. So you will find, Majesty, that I have no interest in disturbing the Eastern Islands if they do not disturb me any further. I have no interest in doing anything but continuing to profit from my endeavors. He waved a vague hand to the papers scattered throughout. Dorian held his tongue. The offer he'd been planning to make. His coffers belonged to Morath now. He doubted privateers would volunteer based on credit. Rowan gave him a look that said the same. Another route to win Rolf to their cause, then. Dorian surveyed the office, the taste leaning toward finery, and yet so little that was not worn. The half-wrecked town around them. The 4 surviving crew. The way Rolf had looked at that band of white along his throat. Rowan opened his mouth, but Dorian said,
They weren't just killed, your crew.
Some were taken, weren't they?
Rolf's sea-green eyes went cold. Dorian pushed.
Captured, along with others, and taken into the Dead Islands. Used for information about how and where to strike you. The only way to free them when they were sent back to you, demons wearing their bodies, was to behead them. Burn them.
Rowan asked roughly,
Was it rings or collars they wore, Captain?
Rolf's throat bobbed once. After a long moment, he said,
Rings. They said they'd been set free, but they weren't the men who...
A shake of the head.
Demons,
he breathed, as if it explained something.
That's what he put in them.
So Rowan told him of the Vog, their princes, and of Erewhon, the last Vog king,
Even Rolf had the wits to look unnerved, as Rowan concluded.
He has cast off the disguise as Parrington. He is only Erewhon now. King Erewhon, apparently.
Rolf's eyes again drifted to Dorian's neck, and it was an effort not to touch the scar there.
How did you survive it? We even cut the rings off, but my men, they were gone.
Dorian shook his head.
I don't know.
No answer didn't make Rolf's men sound lesser for not having survived. Maybe he'd been infested by a Volg prince who'd savored taking his time. Rolf shifted a piece of paper on his desk, reading it again for a heartbeat, as if it were a mere distraction while he thought. He said at last,
"Wiping what's left of them from the Dead Islands won't do shit against the might of Morath."
"No," Rowan countered, "but if we hold the archipelago, we can use these islands to wage a battle from the seas while we strike from the land. We can use these islands to house fleets from other kingdoms, other continents."
Dorian added,
"My hand is currently in the southern continent, in Antica itself. He will persuade them to send a fleet."
Kaol would do nothing less for him, for Otterlin.
"None will come," Rolf said. "They didn't come 10 years ago. They certainly won't come now."
He surveyed Rowan and added with a small smirk, "Especially not with the latest news." This couldn't end well, Dorian decided, as Rowan asked flatly,
"What news?"
Rolf didn't answer, instead watching the stormy bay, or whatever out there held his interest. A rough few months for the man, Dorian realized. Someone holding on to this place through sheer arrogance and will. And all those tables below, assembled from the wreckage of conquered ships. How many enemies were circling, waiting for a shot at revenge? Rowan opened his mouth, no doubt to demand an answer, when Rolf thumped his booted foot thrice on the worn floorboards. An answering thump on the wall sounded. Silence fell. Given Rolf's hatred for the Volg, Dorian doubted Morath was about to spring shut a trap. But he slid deep into his magic as footsteps thudded down the hall. From the tight cast of Rowan's tattooed face, he knew the prince was doing the same, especially as Dorian felt his magic reach toward the Fey princes, as it had done that day with Aelin atop the glass castle. Those footsteps paused outside the office door, and again, that pulse of foreign, mighty magic rose up. Rowan's hand slid into casual distance of the hunting knife at his thigh. Dorian focused on his breathing, on hauling up lines and pieces of his magic. Ice bit into his palms as the office door opened. 2 golden-haired males appeared in the doorway. Rowan's snarl reverberated through the floorboards and along Dorian's feet as he took in the muscle, the pointed ears, the gaping mouths that revealed elongated canines. The 2 strangers, the source of that power. They were Fey. The one with night-dark eyes and an edged grin looked Rowan over and drawled, "I liked your hair longer." A dagger embedding itself in the wall not an inch from the male's ear was Rowan's only answer. Chapter 22. Dorian didn't see the Fey prince throw the dagger until the blade thudded into the wooden wall, its hilt still bobbing with the impact. But the dark-eyed, bronze-skinned male, so handsome that Dorian blinked, smirked at the dagger shivering beside his head. "Was your aim that shitty when you cut your own hair?" The other male beside him, tan, tawny-eyed, with a steady sort of quiet to him,
lifted his broad tattooed hands.
Rowan, put your blades down. We're not here for you.
For there were already more weapons gripped in Rowan's hands. Dorian hadn't even heard him stand, let alone draw the sword, or the elegant hatchet in the other hand. Dorian's magic writhed in his veins as it studied the two strangers.
Here you are, it sang.
Alone with Rowan, his magic had become accustomed to the prince's staggering abyss of power. But the three of these males together, ancient and powerful and primal, they were their own maelstrom. They could wreck this city without even trying. He wondered if Rolf realized it. The pirate lord said dryly,
I take it you know each other.
The solemn golden-eyed one nodded, his pale clothes so like the ones Rowan favored. Layered, efficient fabric, fit for battlefields. A band of black tattoos encircled the male's muscled neck. Dorian's stomach lurched. From a distance, it might very well have been another sort of black collar. Rowan said tightly,
Gavriel and Fenris used to work with me.
Rolf's sea-green eyes darted among them all, assessing, weighing. Fenris, Gavriel. Dorian knew those names. Rowan had mentioned them during their journey here, two members of Rowan's cadre. Rowan explained to Dorian,
They are blood-sworn to Maeve, as I used to be.
Meaning they were here under her orders. And if Maeve had sent not one, but two of her lieutenants to this continent, when Lorcan was already here. Rowan said through his teeth, but sheathed his weapons,
What is your business with Rolf?
Dorian released his magic into himself. It settled into his core like a bit of dropped ribbon. Rolf waved a hand to the two males.
They're the bearer of the news I promised you, among other things.
And we were just sitting down to lunch, Fenris said, those dark eyes dancing. Shall we? Fenris didn't wait for them as he ducked back into the hall and walked out. The tattooed one, Gavriel, sighed quietly.
It's a long tale, Rowan, and one you and the King of Otterlan,
a flick of tawny eyes in his direction,
must hear.
He gestured to the hall and said, utterly stone-faced,
You know how cranky Fenris gets when he doesn't eat.
I heard that, called a deep male voice from the hall. Dorian reined in his smile, watching Rowan for his reaction instead. But the Fey Prince only jerked his head at Gavriel in silent order to lead the way. None of them, not even Rolf, spoke, as they descended into the main room. The barmaid was gone, only sparkling glasses behind the bar hinting that she'd been there. And indeed, digging into a steaming bowl of what smelled like fish stew, Fenris now waited for them at a table in the back. Gavriel slid into a seat beside the warrior, his mostly full bowl sloshing a bit as the table shifted, and said to Rowan, when the prince halted halfway through the room,
Is...
The Fey warrior paused, as if weighing the words and how Rowan might react if the question was posed poorly. Dorian knew why the exact next moment.
Is Aelin Galathinius with you?
Dorian didn't know where to look. At the warriors now at the table, at Rowan beside him, or at Rolf, brows raised as he leaned against the stair banister, with no idea that the queen was his great enemy. Rowan shook his head once, a swift, cutting move.
My queen is not in our company.
Fenris flicked his brows up, but continued devouring his meal, his gray jacket unbuttoned to reveal the muscled brown chest peeking through the V of his white shirt. Gold embroidery swirled along the lapels of the jacket, the only sign of wealth among them. Dorian didn't quite know what had happened this past spring with Rowan's cadre, but they obviously hadn't parted on good terms, at least on Rowan's end. Gavriel rose to drag over two chairs, closest to the exit, Dorian noticed. Perhaps Gavriel was the one who kept the peace among the cadre. Rowan didn't make a move for them. It was so easy to forget that the prince had centuries of handling foreign courts, had gone to war and back again, with these males. Rowan didn't bother with diplomacy, however, as he said, "Tell me whatever the hell this news is." Fenris and Gavriel exchanged a look. The former just rolled his eyes and gestured with his spoon for Gavriel to speak.
"Maeve's armada sails for this continent."
Dorian was glad he didn't have anything in his stomach. Rowan's words were guttural as he asked,
"Is that bitch allying with Morath?"
He cut what Dorian considered to be the definition of an icy stare at Rolf.
"Are you allying with her?"
"No,"
Gavriel said evenly. Rolf, to his credit, just shrugged. "I told you, I want no part in this war."
"Maeve isn't the sort to share power,"
Gavriel cut in calmly.
"But before we left, she was readying her armada to leave. For Ilwe."
Dorian whooshed out a breath.
"Why Ilwe? Is it possible she could be sending aid?"
From the look on Rowan's face, Dorian could tell the prince was already cataloging and marking, analyzing what he knew of his former queen, of Ilwe, and how it tied to everything else. Dorian tried to control his thundering heart, knowing they could likely hear its shift in rhythm. Fenris set down his spoon. "I doubt she's sending aid to anyone at all, at least not where this continent is concerned. And again, she didn't tell us her specific reasons."
"She always tells us," Rowan countered. "She's never contained information like that."
Fenris's dark eyes flickered. "That was before you humiliated her by leaving her for Aelin of the Wildfire, and before Lorkin abandoned her as well. She trusts none of us now."
Ilwe. Maeve had to know how dear the kingdom was to Aelin. But to launch an armada, there had to be something there, something worth her while.
Dorian ran through every lesson he'd been taught, every book he'd read on the kingdom, but nothing sparked. Rowan said,
"Maeve cannot believe she can conquer Ilwe, at least not for any extended period of time, not without drawing all her armies here and leaving her realm undefended."
But perhaps it had spread Erewhon thin, even if the cost of Maeve's invasion would be steep.
"Again," Fenris drawled, "we don't know details. We only told him,"
a jerk of the chin toward where Rolf was still leaned against the banister with crossed arms, "as a courtesy warning, among other things." Dorian noted that Rowan didn't ask if they'd have extended the courtesy to them had they not been here, or what exactly those other things were. The prince said to Rolf,
"I need to dispatch messages. Immediately."
Rolf studied his gloved hands.
"Why bother? Won't the recipient arrive soon enough?"
"What?"
Dorian braced himself at the simmering temper in Rowan's tone. Rolf smiled.
"Rumor has it, Aelin Galathinius destroyed General Narok and his lieutenants over in Wendlin, and that she accomplished this with a fey prince at her side. Impressive."
Rowan's canines flashed. And your point is, Captain? I just wish to know whether Her Majesty Queen of Fire expects a grand parade when she arrives. Dorian doubted Rolf would very much like her other title, Otterlin's Assassin. Rowan's snarl was soft.
Again, she's not coming here.
Oh? You mean to tell me that her lover goes to rescue the King of Otterlin, and instead of taking him north, he brings him here? And it doesn't somehow mean I'm to soon play host to her? At the mention of lover, Rowan gave Fenris a lethal stare. The beautiful male, really, there was no way to describe him other than that, just shrugged. But Rowan said to Rolf,
She asked me to bring King Dorian to persuade you to join our cause. But as you have no interest in any agenda but your own, it seems our trip was wasted. So we have no further use for you at this table, especially if you are incapable of dispatching messengers.
Rowan flicked his eyes toward the stairs behind Rolf.
You're dismissed.
Fenris choked on a dark laugh, but Gavriel straightened as Rolf hissed.
I don't care who you are and what power you wield. You don't give me orders in my territory. You'd better get used to taking them,
Rowan said, his voice calm in that way that made Dorian's every instinct prepare to run.
For if Morath wins this war, they will not be content to let you flounce about these islands pretending to be king. They will lock you out of every port and river, deny you trade with cities that you have come to depend on. Who shall your buyers be when there are none left to purchase your goods? I doubt Maeve will bother or remember you.
Rolf snapped.
If these islands are sacked, we will sail to others and others. The seas are my haven. Upon the waves, we will always be free. I'd hardly call squatting in your tavern in fear of Volg assassins free.
Rolf's gloved hands flexed and unfurled, and Dorian wondered if he'd go for the rapier at his side. But then the pirate lord said to Fenris and Gavriel,
We will meet here tomorrow at 11.
When his gaze shifted to Rowan, it hardened. Send however many damn messages you want. You may stay until your queen arrives, which I have no doubt she will. At that time, I will hear what the legendary Aelin Galathinius has to say for herself. Until then, get the hell out. He jerked his chin toward Gavriel and Fenris. You can talk to the princes at their own damn lodgings. Rolf stalked to the front door, yanking it open to reveal a wall of rain, and the four young but hard-looking men lingering on the soaked quay. Their hands shot to their weapons, but Rolf made no move to summon them. He only pointed out the door. Rowan stared down the man for a moment, then said to his former companions,
Let's go.
They weren't stupid enough to argue. This was bad. Undeniably bad. Rowan's magic frayed apart as he worked to keep the shields around him and Dorian intact. But he didn't let Fenris or Gavriel get a whiff of that exhaustion, didn't reveal one bit of the effort it took to hold the magic and concentrate. Rolf might very well be a lost cause against Erewhon or Maeve, especially once he saw Aelin. If Aelin had been present during this conversation, Rowan had a feeling it would have ended with the sea dragon, both the inn and the ship anchored in the harbor, aflame. But those sea wyverns, and Maeve's armada. He'd think about that later, but shit. Just shit. The no-nonsense innkeeper at the Ocean Rose asked no questions as Rowan purchased two rooms. The best the inn had to offer. Not when he laid a gold piece on the counter.
2 weeks' accommodations, plus all meals, plus stabling of their horses if they had them, and unlimited laundry, she'd offered with a knowing look at his clothes. And whatever guests he wished, she added as Rowan whistled sharply. And Dorian, Fenris, and Gabriel crossed the flagstone courtyard, hoods on as they edged around the burbling fountain. Rain pattered on the potted palms, rustling the magenta bougainvillea crawling up the walls toward the white-painted balconies, still shuttered against the storm. Rowan asked the woman to send up what was likely enough food for 8 people, then stalked for the polished stairs at the back of the dim dining room, the others falling in behind him. Fenris, mercifully, kept his mouth shut until they reached Rowan's room, discarded their cloaks, and Rowan lit a few candles. The act alone left a hole in his chest. Fenris sank into one of the cushioned chairs before the dark fireplace, running a finger down the black-painted arm. Such fine accommodations. Which of the royals is paying, then? Dorian, who had been about to claim the seat by the small desk before the shuttered windows, stiffened. Gavriel gave Fenris a look that said, "Please, no brawling."
"Does it make a difference?"
Rowan asked, as he went wall to wall, lifting the framed pictures of lush flora for any spy holes or access points. Then he checked beneath the white-sheeted bed, its posts of twirled black wood kissed with the candlelight, trying not to consider that for all his resolutions, she'd share this room with him, this bed. The space was secure, serene, even, with the beat of the rain in the courtyard and on the roof, the smell of sweet fruit heavy in the air.
"Someone's gotta have money to finance this war," Fenris purred, watching Rowan at last lean against a low dresser beside the door.
"Though, maybe considering yesterday's decree from Morath, you'll be moving to more economical quarters."
Well, that said enough about what Fenris and Gavriel knew regarding Erewhon's decree concerning Dorian and his allies.
"Worry over your own business, Fenris," Gavriel said.
Fenris snorted, toying with a small curl of golden hair at his nape. "How you even managed to walk with that much steel on you, Whitethorn, has always been a mystery to me." Rowan said smoothly,
"How no one has ever cut out your tongue just to shut you up has always been a mystery to me as well."
An edged chuckle. "I've been told it's my best feature. At least the women think so." A low laugh escaped Dorian, the first sound like it Rowan had witnessed from the king. Rowan braced his hands on the dresser.
"How did you keep your sense hidden?"
Gabriel's tawny eyes darkened.
"A new trick of Maeve's, to keep us nearly invisible in a land that does not receive our kind warmly."
He jerked his chin at Dorian and Rowan,
"though it seems it's not wholly effective."
Rowan said,
"You two better have a damn good explanation for why you're here, and why you dragged Rolf into whatever it is."
Fenris drawled, "You get everything you want, Rowan, yet you're still a stone-cold bastard. Lorcan would be proud."
"Where's Connell?"
was Rowan's mocking reply, naming Fenris's twin. Fenris's face tightened.
"Where do you think? One of us is always the anchor."
"She'd stop keeping him as collateral if you didn't make your discontent so obvious."
Fenris had always been a pain in his ass, and Rowan had not forgotten that it was Fenris who had wanted the task of handling Aelin Galathinius this past spring. Fenris loved anything that was wild and beautiful, and to dangle Aelin before him, Maeve had known it was torture. Perhaps it was torture, too, for Fenris to be so far from Maeve's grip, but to know that his twin was back in Dorinel. That if Fenris never came back, Connell would be punished in unspeakable ways,
It was how the Queen had ensnared them in the first place. Offspring were rare among the Fae. But twins? Even rarer. And for twins to be born gifted with strength, to grow into males whose dominance rivaled that of warriors centuries older than them. Maeve had coveted them. Fenris had refused the offer to join her service. So she'd gone after Connell, the dark to Fenris's gold, quiet to Fenris's roar, thoughtful to Fenris's recklessness. Fenris got what he wanted. Women, glory, wealth. Connell, though skilled, was forever in his twin's shadow. So when the Queen approached him about the Blood Oath, at a time when Fenris, not Connell, had been selected to fight in the war with the Acadians, Connell had sworn it. And when Fenris returned to find his brother bound to the Queen, and learned what Maeve forced him to do behind closed doors, Fenris had bargained. He'd swear the oath, but only to get Maeve to back off his brother. For over a century now, Fenris had served in the Queen's bedroom, had sat chained by invisible shackles beside her dark throne. Rowan might have liked the male, respected him, if it weren't for that damned mouth of his. "So," Fenris said, well aware he had not answered Rowan's demand for information, "are we soon to call you King, Rowan?" Gavriel murmured, "Gods above, Fenris." He gave the sigh of the long-suffering and added before Fenris could open that stupid mouth.
"Your arrival, Rowan, was a fortunate turn of events."
Rowan faced the male beside him, second in command for Maeve now that Rowan had vacated the title. As if the golden-haired warrior read the name from his eyes, Gavriel asked,
"Where is Lorcan?"
Rowan had been debating how to answer that question from the moment he'd seen them. That Gavriel had asked, why had they come to Skull's Bay?
"I don't know where Lorcan is," Rowan said.
Not a lie. If they were lucky, his former commander would get the other two word keys, realize Aelin had tricked him, and come running, delivering the two keys for Aelin to then destroy. If they were lucky. Gavriel said,
"You don't know where he is, but you've seen him."
Rowan nodded. Fenris snorted, "Are we really gonna play truths and lies? Just tell us, you bastard." Rowan pinned Fenris with a look. The White Wolf of Dorinel smiled right back at him. Gods help them all if Fenris and Adian ever sat in a room together. Rowan said,
"Are you here on Maeve's command, ahead of the Armada?"
Gavriel shook his head.
"Our presence has nothing to do with the Armada sailing. She sent us to hunt him. You already know the crime he committed."
An act of love, though only in the twisted way that Lorcan could love things, only in the twisted way he loved Maeve.
"He claims to be doing it in her best interest," Rowan said casually,
aware of the king seated beside him. Rowan knew most underestimated the sharp intelligence under that disarming smile, knew that Dorian's value wasn't his godlike magic, but his mind. He'd latched onto Rolf's fear and trauma at the hands of the Vogue and laid the foundation, one he'd make sure Aelin would exploit. "Lorcan's always been arrogant that way," Fenris drawled. "This time, he crossed the line."
"So you've been sent here to bring Lorcan back?"
Those tattoos on Gavriel's throat, marks Rowan himself had inked, bobbed with each word, as he said,
"We've been sent here to kill him."
Chapter 23. Holy gods,
Rowan froze.
That explains the two of you, then.
Fenris tossed his hair out of his dark eyes. Three, actually. Vaughn left yesterday afternoon to fly north, while we take the south. Vaughn, with his Osprey form, could cover the far harsher terrain more easily. We landed in this shithole town to see if Rolf had dealings with Lorkin, to bribe him to tip us off if Lorkin should come through here again, looking to hire a boat. Skull's Bay would be one of the few ports where Lorkin could do such a thing without questions. Warning Rolf about Maeve's armada was part of convincing the bastard to help us. We're to make our way onto the continent from here, start our hunt in the south, and since these lands are rather large, a flash of white teeth and a feral smile, any inkling about his general whereabouts would be much appreciated. Prince. Rowan debated it. But if they caught Lorkin, and the commander had possession of even one of the word keys, if they brought both commander and keys back to Maeve, especially if she was already sailing for Eelway for whatever reasons of her own. Rowan shrugged.
I washed my hands of you all this spring. Lorkin's business is his own.
You prick, Fenris snarled. Gavriel cut in.
If we could bargain?
There was something like pain and regret in Gavriel's eyes. Of all of them, Gavriel had probably been his only friend. Rowan debated if he should tell him about the son who was now making his way here. Debated if Adian would like the chance to meet his father. Perhaps before war-made corpses of them all. But Rowan said,
Has Maeve given you leave to bargain on her behalf?
We only received our orders, Fenris drawled, and the permission to use any means necessary to kill Lorkin. She did not mention your queen at all, so that amounts to a yes. Rowan crossed his arms.
You send me an army of Dorinel warriors, and I'll tell you where Lorkin is, and where he plans to go.
Fenris let out a harsh laugh.
Mother's tits, Rowan. Even if we could, the armada's already in use. I suppose I'll have to make do with you two, then.
Dorian had the good sense not to look as surprised as Rowan's former brothers-in-arms. Fenris burst out laughing.
What? Work for your queen? Fight in your battles? Isn't that what you want, Fenris?
Rowan fixed him with a stare.
To serve my queen? You've been pulling on the leash for months. Well, here's your shot.
All amusement faded from Fenris's beautiful face.
You're a bastard, Rowan.
Rowan turned to Gavriel.
I'm assuming Maeve didn't specify when you had to do this.
A shallow nod was his only confirmation.
And you will technically be fulfilling her command to you.
The blood oath operated on specific, clear demands, and relied on close physical contact to enable that tug to get the body to yield. This far away, they had to obey Maeve's orders, but could use any loopholes in the language to their own advantage.
Lorkin might very well be gone by the time you've considered our bargain fulfilled, Fenris countered.
Rowan smiled a bit.
Ah, but the thing is, Lorkin's path will eventually lead him right back to me, to my queen. Who knows how long it will take, but he will find us again, at which time he'll be yours.
He tapped a finger against his bicep.
People are going to be talking about this war for 1,000 years. Longer.
Rowan jerked his chin at Fenris.
You've never shied from a fight.
That's if we survive, Fenris said. And what of Brannan's gifts? How long will a single flame last against the darkness that gathers? Maeve hid her motives about the Armada and Eelway, but she at least told us who really reigns in Morath.
When Rowan had walked through the door of the Sea Dragon,
He'd wondered what god had sent the storm that had pushed them to arrive in Skull's Bay on this day, at this time. Together, he and the cadre had taken on a legion of Otterland's forces this spring, and won, easily. And even if Lorcan, Vaughn, and Connell weren't with them, one Fey warrior was as good as 100 mortal soldiers, maybe more. Terrasen needed more troops. Well, here was a 3-male army. And against the aerial Iron Teeth legions, they would need Fey speed and strength and centuries of experience. Together, they had sacked cities and kingdoms for Maeve. Together, they had waged war and ended it. Rowan said,
10 years ago, we did nothing to stop this.
If Maeve had sent a force, we might have kept it from growing so out of control. Our brethren were hunted and killed and tortured. Maeve let it happen for spite, because Aelin's mother would not yield to her wishes. So yes, my fire heart is one flame in the Sea of Darkness. But she is willing to fight, Fenris. She is willing to take on Erewhon, take on Maeve and the gods themselves if it means peace can be had.
Across the room, Dorian's eyes had shuddered.
Rowan knew the king would fight and go down swinging, and that his gift could make a difference between victory and defeat. Yet, he was untrained, still untried despite all he'd endured.
But Aelin is one person,
Rowan went on,
and even her gifts might not be enough to win. Alone,
he breathed, meeting Fenris's stare, then Gavriel's.
She will die. And once that flame goes out, it is done. There is no second chance. Once that fire extinguishes, we are all doomed in every land and every world.
The words were poison on his tongue, his very bones aching at the thought of that death. What he'd do if it should happen. Gavriel and Fenris looked at each other, speaking in that silent way he used to do with them. There was one card Rowan had to play to convince them. To convince Gavriel. Even if the specificity of Maeve's command might allow it, she could very well punish them for acting around her orders. She'd done it before. They all bore scars from it. They knew the risk of it as well as Rowan did. Gavriel shook his head slightly at Fenris. Before they could turn to say no, Rowan said to Gavriel,
"If you do not fight in this war, Gavriel, then you doom your son to die."
Gavriel froze. Fenris spat, "Bullshit." Even Dorian was gaping a bit. Rowan wondered just how pissed Adian would be as he said,
"Think on my proposal. But know that your son makes for Skull's Bay. You may want to wait to decide until you meet him."
"Who?"
Rowan wasn't sure Gavriel was breathing properly. The warrior's hands were clenched so tightly, the scars over his knuckles were moon white.
"I have a son."
Some part of Rowan felt like the prick Fenris claimed he was, and not the male that Aelin believed him to be, as he nodded. The information would have gotten out sooner or later. If Maeve had learned first, she might have schemed to ensnare Adian, might have sent the cadre to kill or steal him. But now, Rowan supposed, he'd ensnared the cadre himself. It was only a matter of how desperately Gavriel wanted to meet his son, and how afraid they were of failing Maeve, should they not find Lorcan. So Rowan said coldly,
"Stay out of our way until they arrive, and we'll stay out of yours."
Putting his back to them went against every instinct, but Rowan kept his shields tight. His magic spread to alert him,
if either so much as breathed wrong while he twisted to open the bedroom door in silent dismissal. He had much to do, starting with writing a warning to the Eelway Royals and Terrasen's forces, ending with trying to figure out how the hell they could fight two wars at once. Gabriel rose, slack-faced, pale, something like devastation written there. Rowan caught the spark of realization that flashed across Dorian's eyes, a heartbeat before the king buried it. Yes. At first glance, Adian and Aelin looked like siblings, but it was Adian's smile that gave away his heritage. Gabriel would know in a heartbeat, if Adian's scent didn't give it away first. Fenris stepped closer to the male, a hand on his shoulder as they entered the hallway. For both Rowan and Fenris, Gabriel had always been their sounding board. Never each other. No, he and Fenris. It was easier to be at each other's throats instead. Rowan said to both of his former companions,
"If you so much as hint about Gabriel's son to Maeve, our bargain is over. You'll never find Lorcan. And if Lorcan does show up, I'll gladly help him kill you."
Rowan prayed it wouldn't come to it, to a fight that brutal and devastating. This was war, though, and he had no intention of losing it. Chapter 24. The Windsinger left Ilium at dawn. Its crew and captain, unaware that the two hooded individuals and their pet falcon, who had paid in gold, had no intention of going the entire journey to Lareba. Whether they pieced together that those two individuals were also the general and queen who had liberated their town the night before, they didn't let on. It was considered an easy trip down the coast of the continent, though Aelin wondered if voicing that statement would guarantee it wasn't an easy trip. First, there was the matter of sailing through Otterland's waters, near Rifthold specifically. If the witches patrolled far out to sea. But they had no other choice, not with the net Erewhon had stretched across the continent, not with his threat to find and capture Rowan and Dorian still ringing fresh in her mind, along with the throbbing of the deep purple bruise on her chest, right over her heart. Standing on the deck of the ship, the rising sun staining the turquoise bay of Ilium with gold and pink, Aelin wondered if the next time she'd see these waters, they'd be red. Wondered how long the Otterlanian soldiers would remain on their side of the border. Adian stepped to her side, finished with his third inspection.
"Everything looks fine."
Lysandra said all was clear. Indeed, from high up on the mainmast of the ship, Lysandra's falcon eyes missed nothing. Adian frowned.
"You know, you ladies can let us males do things every now and then."
Aelin lifted a brow. Where would the fun be in that? But she knew this would be an ongoing argument, stepping back so that others, so that Adian, might fight for her. It had been bad enough in Rifthold. Bad enough knowing that those rings and collars might enslave them. But what Erewhon had done to that overseer, as an experiment. Aelin glanced toward the scurrying crew, biting back her demand to hurry. Every minute delayed could be one that Erewhon closed in on Rowan and Dorian. It was only a matter of time before a report reached him regarding where they'd been spotted. Aelin tapped her foot on the deck. The rocking of the ship on the calm waves echoed the beat of her foot. She'd always loved the smell and feel of the sea. But now, even the lapping of those waves seemed to say, "Hurry, hurry."
"The King of Otterlan, and Parrington, I suppose, had me in their grasp for years,"
Adian said. His voice was tight enough that Aelin turned from the sea to face him. He'd gripped the wooden railing,
the scars on his hands stark against his summer-tanned skin.
They met with me in Terrasen, in Otterlin. He had me in his rotting dungeon, gods above. And yet he didn't do that to me. He offered me the ring, but didn't notice I wore a fake instead. Why not cleave me open and corrupt me? He had to know. He had to know that you'd come for me.
The king left Dorian alone for as long as he could. Perhaps that goodness extended to you too. Perhaps he knew that if you were gone, I might very well have decided to let this world go to hell and never free him for spite.
Would you have done that? The people you love are just weapons that will be used against you,
Rowan had once told her. Don't waste your energy worrying about what could have been.
She knew she hadn't answered his question.
Adian didn't look at her, as he said.
I knew what happened in Endovir, Aelin. But seeing that overseer, hearing what he said.
His throat bobbed.
I was so close to the salt mines. That year, I was camped with the Bane right over the border for 3 months.
She whipped her head to him. We're not starting down this road. Erewhon sent that man for a reason, for this reason. He knows my past, wants me to know he's aware of it, and will use it against me. Against us. He'll use everyone we know if he needs to.
Adian sighed. Would you have told me what happened last night, if I hadn't been there?
I don't know. I bet you would have awoken as soon as I unleashed my power on him.
He snorted. It's hard to miss.
The crying of gulls swooping overhead filled the quiet that followed. Despite her declaration not to linger in the past, Aelin said carefully, Darrow claimed you fought at Theralis. She'd been meaning to ask for weeks, but hadn't worked up the nerve. Adian fixed his stare on the churning water.
It was a long time ago.
She swallowed against the burning in her throat. You were barely 14.
I was.
His jaw tightened. She could only imagine the carnage and the horror, not just of a boy killing and fighting, but seeing the people they cared for fall, one by one. I'm sorry, she breathed, that you had to endure it. Adian turned toward her, no hint of the haughty arrogance and insolence.
Theralis is the battlefield I see the most. In my dreams.
He scratched at a fleck on the rail.
Darrow made sure I stayed out of the thick of it, but we were overwhelmed. It was unavoidable.
He'd never told her that Darrow had tried to shield him. She put a hand atop Adian's and squeezed. I'm sorry, she said again. She couldn't bring herself to ask more.
He shrugged with a shoulder. My life as a warrior was chosen long before that battlefield.
Indeed. She couldn't imagine him without that sword and shield, both currently strapped across his back. She couldn't decide if it was a good thing. Silence settled between them, heavy and old and weary. I don't blame him, Aelin said at last. I don't blame Darrow for blocking me from Terrasen. I would do the same, judge the same, if I were him.
Adian frowned. I thought you were going to fight his decree.
I am, she swore, but I understand why Darrow did it. Adian observed her before nodding. A grave nod, from one soldier to another. She put a hand against the amulet beneath her clothes. Its ancient, otherworldly power rubbed up against her, and a shiver went down her spine. Find the lock. Good thing Skull's Bay was on their way to the stone marshes of Eelway, and good thing that its ruler possessed a magical map inked on his hands. A map that revealed enemies, storms, and hidden treasure. A map to find things that did not wish to be found. Aelin lowered her hand, propping both on the rail and examining the scar across each palm. So many promises and oaths made, so many debts and favors to still call in. Aelin wondered what answers and oaths she might find waiting in Skull's Bay. If they got there before Erewhon did. Chapter 25. Manon Blackbeak awoke to the sighing of leaves, the distant call of wary birds, and the reek and loam of ancient wood. She groaned as she opened her eyes, squinting at the dappled sunlight through heavy canopy cover. She knew these trees. Oakwald. She was still strapped in the saddle, Abraxo sprawled beneath her, neck craned so he could monitor her breaths. His dark eyes widened with panic as she moaned, trying to sit up. She'd fallen flat onto her back, had undoubtedly lain here for some time, judging by the blue blood coating Abraxos's sides. Manon lifted her head to peer at her stomach and bit back a cry as muscles pulled. Wet warmth trickled from her abdomen. The wounds had barely set then, if they were tearing so easily. Her head pounded like a thousand forges, and her mouth was so dry she could barely shift her tongue. First order of business? Get out of this saddle, then try to assess herself, then water. A stream babbled nearby, close enough that she wondered if Abraxos had chosen this spot for it. He huffed, shifting in worry, and she hissed as her stomach tore more.
Stop, she rasped. I'm fine.
She wasn't fine. Not even close. But she wasn't dead, and that was a start. The other bullshit, her grandmother, the 13, the Kraken claim. She'd deal with it once she didn't have one foot in the darkness. Manon lay there for long minutes, breathing against the pain. Clean the wound, staunch the bleeding. She had nothing on her but her leathers. But her shirt. She didn't have the strength to boil the linen first. She'd just have to pray that the immortality gracing her blood would drive off any infection. The Kraken blood in her. Manon sat up in a sudden jerk, not giving herself time to balk, biting down on her scream so hard her lip bled, a coppery tang filling her mouth. But she was up. Blood dribbled from beneath her flying leathers, but she focused on unstrapping the harness, one buckle at a time. She was not dead. The mother still had some use for her. Free of the harness, Manon stared at the drop off Abraxos, onto the mossy ground. Darkness save her. This was going to hurt. Just shifting her body to pivot her leg over one side made her clench her teeth against the sobbing. If her grandmother's nails had been poisoned, she'd be dead. But they had been left jagged, jagged instead of honed, and full of rust. A large head nudged at her knee, and she found Abraxos there, neck stretched, his head just below her feet, the offer in his eyes. Not trusting consciousness to keep its grip much longer, Manon slid onto his wide, broad head, breathing through the ripples of fiery pain. His breath warmed her chilled skin as he gently lowered her onto the grassy clearing. She lay on her back, letting Abraxos nose her, a faint whine breaking from him.
Fine, she breathed.
Manon awoke at twilight. Abraxos was curled around her, his wing angled to form a makeshift covering. At least she was warm, but her thirst. Manon groaned, and the wing instantly snapped back, revealing a leathery head and concerned eyes.
You, Mother Hen,
she gasped out, sliding her arms beneath her and pushing up.
Oh gods, oh gods, oh gods.
But she was in a sitting position. Water. That stream. Abraxos was too big to reach it through the trees, but she needed water. Soon. How many days had it been? How much blood had she lost?
Help,
she breathed. Powerful jaws closed around the collar of her tunic. Hoisting her up with such gentleness, Manon's chest tightened. She swayed, bracing a hand on his leathery side, but stayed upright. Water. Then she could sleep more.
Wait here,
she said, stumbling to the nearest tree, a hand on her belly, Windcleaver a weight on her back. She debated leaving the sword behind, but any extra movement, even unbuckling the belt from across her chest, was unthinkable. Tree to tree, she staggered, nails digging into each trunk to keep herself upright, her ragged breathing filling the silent forest.
She was alive.
She was alive. The stream was barely more than a trickle through some mossy boulders, but it was clear and fast, and the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen. Manon surveyed the water. If she knelt, could she get back up? She'd sleep here if she had to, once she drank. Carefully, muscles trembling, she knelt at the bank. She swallowed her cry as she bowed over the stream, as more blood slid out. She drank the first few handfuls without stop, then slowed, her stomach aching inside and out now. A twig snapped, and Manon was on her feet, instinct overriding pain so fast the agony hit her a breath later. But she scanned the trees, the rocks and canopy, and little hills. A cool female voice said from across the stream,
It seems you have fallen far from your eyrie, Blackbeak.
Manon couldn't place who it belonged to, what witch she'd met. From behind the shadows of a tree, a stunning young woman emerged. Her body was supple yet lithe, her unbound auburn hair draping to partially cover her nakedness. Not a stitch of clothing covered that cream-colored skin. Not a scar or mark marred flesh as pure as snow. The woman's silken hair moved with her as she stepped closer. But the woman was no witch, and her blue eyes. Run, run! Eyes of glacier blue gleamed even in the shadowed wood, and a full red mouth made for the bedroom parted in a too white smile as she took in Manon. The blood, the injury. Abraxos roared in warning, shaking the ground, the trees, the leaves.
Who are you?
Manon said, her voice raw. The young woman cocked her head, a robin studying a writhing worm.
The Dark King calls me his bloodhound.
Manon made every breath count as she rallied her strength.
Never heard of you,
Manon rasped. Something too dark to be blood slithered under the cream-colored skin of the woman's abdomen, then vanished. She traced a small, beautiful hand over where it had squirmed across the curve of her taut belly.
You would not have heard of me. Until your treachery, I was kept beneath those other mountains. But when he honed the power within my own blood...
Those blue eyes pierced Manon, and it was madness that glittered there.
He could do much with you, Blackbeak. So much. He sent me to bring his crowned rider to his side once more.
Manon backed away a step. Just one.
There is nowhere to flee. Not with your belly barely inside you.
She tossed her auburn hair over a shoulder.
Oh, what fun we'll have now that I've found you, Blackbeak. All of us.
Manon braced herself, drawing Windcleaver as the woman's form glowed like a black sun, then rippled, the edges expanding, morphing, until... The woman had been an illusion, a glamour. The creature that stood before her had been birthed in darkness, so white she doubted it had ever felt the kiss of the sun until now. And the mind that had invented it. The imagination of someone born in another world, one where nightmares prowled the dark, cold earth. The body and face were vaguely human, but... Bloodhound. Yes, that was fitting. The nostrils were enormous, the eyes so large and lidless she wondered if Erewhon himself had spread her eyelids apart, and her mouth. The teeth were black stumps, the tongue thick and red, for tasting the air. And spreading from that white body, the method of Manon's transportation.
Wings. You see,
the bloodhound purred.
You see what he can give you. I can now taste the wind, smell its very marrow. Just as I smelled you across the land.
Manon kept an arm cradled over her belly as the other trembled, lifting Windcleaver. The bloodhound laughed, low and soft.
I shall enjoy this, I think,
she said, and pounced. Alive. She was alive, and she would stay that way. Manon jumped back, sliding between two trees, so close that the creature hit them, a wall of wood in her way. Those calf eyes narrowed in rage, and her white hands, tipped with earth-digging claws, sank into the wood as she backtracked, only to be stuck. Maybe the mother was watching over her. The bloodhound had lodged herself between the two trees, half in, half out, thanks to those wings, wood squeezing. Manon ran. Pain ripped at her with each step, and she sobbed through her teeth as she sprinted between the trees. A snap and crash of wood and leaves from behind. Manon pushed herself, a hand shoved against her wound, gripping Windcleaver tight enough it shook. But there was Abraxos, eyes wild, wings already flapping, preparing for flight.
Oh,
she rasped, flinging herself at him as wood crunched behind her. Abraxos launched for her as she leaped for him, not onto him, but into his claws, into the mighty talons that wrapped her under her breasts, her stomach tearing a bit more as he hefted her up, 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 through wood and leaf and nest. The air snapped beneath her boots, and Manon, eyes streaming, peered down to see the bloodhound's claws reaching wildly. But too late. A shriek of rage on her lips, the bloodhound backed a few steps to the edge of the clearing, preparing to get a running leap into the air, as Abraxos's wings beat like hell. They cleared the canopy, his wings shattering branches, raining them onto the bloodhound. The wind tore at Manon as Abraxos sailed with her, higher and higher, heading east, toward the plains, east and south. The thing wouldn't be detained long. Abraxos realized it too. Had planned for it. A flicker of white broke through the canopy below them. Abraxos lunged, a swift, lethal dive, his roar of rage making Manon's head buzz. The bloodhound didn't have time to bank as Abraxos's mighty tail slammed into her, poison-coated steel barbs hitting home. Black, festering blood sprayed, ivory membranous wings sundered. Then they were sweeping back up, and the bloodhound was tumbling down through the canopy. Dying or injured, Manon didn't care. I will find you, the bloodhound screeched from the forest floor. It was miles before the screamed words faded. Manon and Abraxos paused only long enough for her to crawl onto his back and strap herself in. No signs of other wyverns in the skies. No hint of the bloodhound pursuing them. Perhaps that poison would keep her down for a while, if not permanently.
To the coast,
Manon said over the wind, as the sky bled crimson into a final blackness.
Somewhere safe.
Blood trickled from between her fingers, faster, stronger than before. Only a moment before the darkness claimed her again. Chapter 26. Even after 2 weeks in Skull's Bay, being utterly ignored by Rolf despite their requests to meet with him, Dorian still wasn't entirely used to the heat and humidity. It hounded him day and night, driving him from sleep to wake drenched in sweat, chasing him inside the ocean rose when the sun was at its zenith. And since Rolf refused to see them, Dorian tried to fill his days with things other than complaining about the heat. Mornings were for practicing his magic in a jungle clearing a few miles away. Worse, Rowan made him run there and back, and when they returned at lunch, he had the choice of eating before or after one of Rowan's grueling workouts. Honestly, Dorian had no idea how Aelin had survived months of this, let alone fallen in love with the warrior while she did. Though he supposed both the queen and prince possessed a sadistic streak that made them compatible. Some days, Fenris and Gavriel met them in the inn's courtyard to either exercise or give unwanted pointers on Dorian's technique with a sword and dagger. Some days, Rowan let them stay. Others, he kicked them out with a snarl. The latter, Dorian realized, usually happened when even the heat and sun couldn't drive away the shadows of the past few months. When he awoke with his sweat feeling like Sorsha's blood. When he couldn't abide even the brush of his tunic against his neck. He wasn't sure whether to thank the Fey Prince for noticing, or to hate him for the kindness. During the afternoons, he and Rowan prowled the city for gossip and news, watching Rolf's men as closely as they were watched. Only 7 captains of Rolf's depleted armada were on the island, 8 including Rolf, with fewer ships anchored in the bay. Some had fled after the Volg attack. Some now slept with the fishes at the bottom of the harbor, their ships with them. Reports poured in from Rifthold. Of the city under witch command, of most of it in ruin, its nobility and merchants fleeing to country estates and leaving the poor to fend for themselves. The witches controlled the city gates and the docks. Nothing and no one got in without them knowing. Worse, ships from the Farian Gap were sailing down the Avery toward Rifthold, carrying strange soldiers and beasts that turned the city into their own personal hunting ground. Erewhon was no fool with planning this war. Those ships prowling the Avery were too small, Rowan had claimed, and there was no way the force at the dead end was the entirety of Erewhon's armada. So where had Otterlin's fleet been all this time? Rowan discovered the answer 5 days into their stay, the Gulf of Oro. Some of the fleet had been positioned near Ilway's northwestern coast, some hidden in Melisande's ports, where, rumor had it, their queen was allowing Morath soldiers in through any direction they pleased. Erewhon had skillfully divided his fleet, placing it at enough key locations that Rowan informed Dorian they'd have to sacrifice land, allies, and geographical advantages in order to hold others. Dorian had hated to admit to the Fey warrior that he'd never heard of any of these plans these past years. His council meetings had all been on policy and trade and slaves. A distraction, he realized. A way to keep the lords and rulers of the continent focused on one thing, while other plans were set in motion. And now, if Erewhon summoned the fleet from the Gulf, they'd likely sail around Ilway's southern coast and sack every city until they reached Orinth's doorstep. Perhaps they'd get lucky, and Erewhon's fleet would collide with Maeve's. Not that they'd heard anything of the latter. Not even a whisper of where and how fast her ship sailed, or a whisper of where Aelin Galathinius had gone. It was for news of her, Dorian knew, that Rowan hunted through the city's streets. So Dorian and Rowan collected kernels of information and would return to the inn each night to analyze them over spiced prawns from the warm waters of the archipelago and steaming rice from traders in the southern continent, their glasses of orange-infused water resting atop the maps and charts they'd purchased in town. Information was mostly second or third hand, and a common whore patrolling the streets seemed to know as much as the sailors laboring at the docks. But none of the whores or the sailors or the traders had news of Prince Holland's or Queen Georgina's fates. War was coming, and the fate of a child and a flippant queen who had never bothered to take power for herself was of little concern to anyone but Dorian, it seemed. On a particularly steamy afternoon, cooling off now thanks to a dazzling thunderstorm, Dorian set down his fork beside his plate of steamed reef fish and said to Rowan, "I find I'm tired of waiting for Rolf to meet with us." Rowan's fork clinked against his plate as he lowered it, and waited with preternatural stillness. Where Gavriel and Fenris were for the afternoon, he didn't care. Dorian was actually grateful for their absence, as he said, "I need some paper, and a messenger." Rolf summoned them and the cadre to the Sea Dragon Tavern 3 hours later. Rowan had been teaching him about shielding these past few days, and Dorian erected one around himself as Rolf led the four of them along the upstairs hall of the tavern, heading for his office. His idea had unfolded smoothly, perfectly. No one had noticed that the letter Rowan mailed after lunch was the same one that was later delivered to Dorian at the inn. But Rolf's spies noticed the shock that Dorian displayed while reading it, the dismay and fear and rage at whatever news he'd received. Rowan, true to form, had paced and snarled at the news he'd attained. They made sure the servant washing the hallway had overheard their mention of war-altering information, that Rolf himself could gain much from it, or lose everything. And now, striding for the man's office, Dorian couldn't tell if it pleased or unnerved him that they were so closely watched that his plan had worked. Gavriel and Fenris, thankfully, asked no questions. The pirate lord, clad in a faded blue and gold jacket, paused before the oak door to his office. His gloves were on, his face a bit haggard. He doubted that expression would improve when Rolf realized there was no news whatsoever, and he'd have this meeting whether he wanted to or not. Dorian caught the three Fey males assessing Rolf's each breath, his posture, listening to the sounds of the first mate and quartermaster a level below. All three of them exchanged barely perceptible nods. Allies. At least until Rolf heard them out. Rolf unlocked the door, muttering, "This had better be worth my time," and stalked into the awaiting dimness beyond. Then stopped dead. Even in the watery light, Dorian could perfectly see the woman sitting at Rolf's desk, her black clothes dirty, weapons gleaming, and her feet propped on the dark wooden surface. Aelin Galathinius, her hands laced behind her head, grinned at them all and said, "I like this office far better than your other one, Rolf." Chapter 27. Dorian didn't dare move as Rolf let out a snarl. "I have a distinct memory, Selena Sardathian, of saying that if you set foot in my territory again, your life was forfeit." "Ah," Aelin said, lowering her hands but leaving her feet still propped on Rolf's desk. "But where would the fun be in that?" Rowan was still as death beside him. Aelin's grin became feline as she finally lowered her feet and ran her hands along either side of the desk, assessing the smooth wood as if it was a prize horse. She inclined her head to Dorian. "Hello, Majesty."
"Hello, Selena," he said as calmly as he could,
well aware that two females behind him could hear his thundering heart. Rolf whipped his head toward him. Because it was Selena who sat here. For whatever purpose, it was Selena Sardathian in this room. She jerked her chin at Rolf. "You've seen better days, but considering half your fleet has abandoned you, I'd say you look decent enough."
"Get out of my chair," Rolf said too quietly.
Aelin did no such thing. She just gave Rowan a sultry sweep from foot to face. Rowan's expression remained unreadable, eyes intent, near glowing. And then Aelin said to Rowan with a secret smile,
"You, I don't know, but I'd like to."
Rowan's lips tugged upward.
"I'm not on the market, unfortunately."
"Pity,"
Aelin said, cocking her head as she noticed a bowl of small emeralds on Rolf's desk.
"Don't do it, don't."
Aelin swiped up the emeralds in a hand, picking them over as she glanced at Rowan beneath her lashes.
"She must be a rare, staggering beauty to make you so faithful."
"God save them all."
He could have sworn Fenris coughed behind him. Aelin chucked the emeralds into the metal dish as if they were bits of copper, their plunking the only sound.
"She must be clever, plunk, and fascinating,
plunk,
and very, very talented."
"Plunk, plunk, plunk,"
went the emeralds. She examined the four gems remaining in her hand.
"She must be the most wonderful person who ever existed."
Another cough from behind him, from Gavriel this time. But Aelin only had eyes for Rowan, as the warrior said to her,
"She is indeed that, and more."
"Hmm,"
Aelin said, rolling the emeralds in her scarred palm with expert ease. Rolf growled,
"What are you doing here?"
Aelin dumped the emeralds into their dish.
"Is that any way to speak to an old friend?"
Rolf stalked toward the desk, and Rowan trembled with restraint as the pirate lord braced his hands on the wooden surface.
"Last I heard, your master was dead and you sold the guild to his underlings. You're a free woman. What are you doing in my city?"
Aelin met his sea-green eyes with an irreverence that Dorian wondered if she had been born with or had honed through skill and blood and adventure.
"War is coming, Rolf. Am I not allowed to weigh my options? I thought to see what you planned to do."
Rolf looked over his broad shoulder at Dorian.
Rumor has it she was your champion this fall. Do you wish to deal with this? Dorian said smoothly, You will find, Rolf, that one does not deal with Selena Sardothian. One survives her. A flash of a grin from Aelin. Rolf rolled his eyes and said to the assassin queen, So what is the plan, then? You made a bargain to get out of Endovir, became the king's champion, and now that he is dead, you wish to see how you might profit. Dorian tried not to flinch. Dead. His father was dead. At his own hands. You know how my tastes run, Aelin said. Even with Erebon's fortune and the sale of the guild, war can be a profitable time for people who are smart with their business. And where is the 16-year-old self-righteous brat who wrecked 6 of my ships, stole 2 of them, and destroyed my town, all for the sake of 200 slaves? A shadow flickered in Aelin's eyes that sent a chill down Dorian's spine. Spend a year in Endovir, Rolf, and you quickly learn how to play a different sort of game. I told you. Rolf seethed with quiet venom, that you'd one day pay for that arrogance. Aelin's smile became lethal. Indeed I did, and so did Erebon Hommel. Rolf blinked, just once, then straightened. Get out of my seat, and put back that emerald you slipped up your sleeve. Aelin snorted, and with a flash of her fingers, an emerald, the 4th one Dorian had forgotten, appeared between her fingers. Good. At least your eyesight isn't failing in your old age. And the other one, Rolf said through clenched teeth. Aelin grinned again, and then leaned back in Rolf's chair, tipped up her head, and spat out an emerald she'd somehow kept hidden under her tongue. Dorian watched the gem arc neatly through the air. Its plunk in the dish was the only sound. Dorian glanced at Rowan, but delight shone in the prince's eyes. Delight and pride and simmering lust. Dorian quickly looked away. Aelin said to the pirate lord, I have 2 questions for you. Rolf's hand twitched toward his rapier. You're in no rutting position to ask questions. Aren't I? After all, I made you a promise 2.5 years ago, one that you signed. Rolf snarled. Aelin propped her chin on a fist. Have you or have any of your ships bought, traded, or transported slaves since that unfortunate day?
No.
A satisfied little nod. And have you provided sanctuary for them here?
We haven't gone out of our way, but if any arrived, yes.
Each word was tighter than the last, a spring about to burst forward and throttle the queen. Dorian prayed the man wouldn't be dumb enough to draw on her, not with Rowan watching his every breath.
Good and good, Aelin said. Smart of you, not to lie to me. As I took it upon myself when I arrived this morning to look into your warehouses, to ask around in the markets, and then I came here. She ran her hands over the papers and books on the desk. To see your ledgers for myself. She dragged a finger down a page containing various columns and numbers. Textiles, spices, porcelain diningware, rice from the southern continent, and various contraband. But no slaves. I have to say I'm impressed, both at you honoring your word and at your thorough record-keeping. A low snarl.
Do you know what your stunt cost me?
Aelin flicked her eyes toward a piece of parchment on the wall. Various daggers, swords, and even scissors embedded in it. Target practice, apparently, for Rolf.
Well, there's the bar tab I left unpaid. She said of the document. which was indeed a list of items, and, holy gods, that was a large sum of money. Rolf turned to Rowan, Fenris, and Gavriel.
You want my assistance in this war? Here's the cost. Kill her. Now. Then my ships and men are yours.
Fenris's dark eyes glittered, but not at Rolf, as Aelin rose to her feet. Her black clothes were travel-worn, her golden hair gleaming in the gray light. And even in a room of professional killers, she took the lion's share of air.
Oh, I don't think they will, she said,
or even can. Rolf whirled to her. You'll find that you are not so skilled in the face of Fey warriors. She pointed to one of the chairs before the desk.
You might want to sit.
Get the hell out of—
Aelin let out a low whistle.
Allow me to introduce to you, Captain Rolf, the incomparable, the beautiful, and the absolutely and all-around flawless Queen of Terrasen.
Dorian's brows creased, but footsteps sounded, and then the males shifted, as Aelin Galathinius indeed strode into the room, clad in a dark green tunic of equal wear and dirt, her golden hair unbound, her turquoise and gold eyes laughing, as she strode past a slack-jawed Rolf and perched on the arm of Aelin's chair. Dorian couldn't tell. Without a fey sense of smell, he couldn't tell.
What devilry is this?
Rolf hissed, yielding a single step. Aelin and Aelin looked at each other. The one in black grinned up at the newcomer.
Oh, you are gorgeous, aren't you?
The one in green smiled, but for all its delight, all its wicked mischief, it was a softer smile, made with a mouth that was perhaps less used to snarling and teeth-baring and getting away with saying hideous, swaggering things. Lysandra, then. The two queens faced Rolf.
Aelin Galathinius had no twin,
he growled, a hand on his sword. Aelin, in black, the true Aelin, who had been among them all along, rolled her eyes.
Ugh, Rolf, you ruin my fun. Of course I don't have a twin.
She jerked her chin at Lysandra, and the shifter's flesh glowed and melted, hair becoming a heavy, straight fall of dark tresses, her skin sun-kissed, her up-tilted eyes a striking green. Rolf barked in alarm and staggered back, only for Fenris to steady himself with a hand on his shoulder, as the Fey warrior stepped forward, eyes wide.
A shifter,
Fenris breathed. Aelin and Lysandra fixed the warrior with an unimpressed look that would have sent lesser men running. Even Gavriel's placid face was slack at the sight of the shapeshifter, his tattoos bobbing as he swallowed. Adian's father. And if Adian was here with Aelin?
As intrigued as I am to see that the cadre is present, Aelin said, will you verify to his pirateness that I am who I say I am, and we can move on to more pressing matters?
Rolf's face was white with fury, as he realized they'd all known who truly sat before them. Dorian said,
she is Aelin Galathinius, and Selena Sardothian.
But it was to Fenris and Gavriel, the outside party, that Rolf turned. Gavriel nodded, Fenris's eyes now fixed on the queen.
She is who she says she is.
Rolf turned to Aelin, but the queen frowned up at Lysandra as the shifter handed her a wax-sealed tube.
You made your hair shorter.
You try hair that long and see if you last more than a day, Lysandra said, fingering the hair brushing her collarbone. Rolf gaped at them. Aelin grinned at her companion and faced the pirate lord.
So, Rolf, the queen drawled,
tossing the tube from hand to hand. Let's discuss this little business of you refusing to aid my cause. Chapter 28. Aelin Galathinius didn't bother to contain her smugness, as Rolf pointed to the large table on the right side of his office, far grander than the piece of shit office where he'd once had her and Sam meet him. She managed all of one step toward her designated seat, before Rowan was at her side, a hand on her elbow. His face, oh gods, she'd missed that harsh, unyielding face, was tight, as he leaned in to whisper with Fae softness.
The cadre is working with us on the condition that it'll lead them to Lorcan, since Maeve sent them to kill him. I refused to divulge his whereabouts. Most of Otterland's fleet is in the Gulf of Oro, thanks to some foul agreement with Melisande to use their ports, and Maeve's own armada sails for Eelway. Whether to attack or aid, we don't know.
Well, it was nice to know absolute hell awaited them, and that the information about Maeve's armada was correct. But then Rowan added,
"And I missed you like hell."
She smiled despite what he'd told her, pulling back to look at him. Untouched. Unharmed. It was more than she could have hoped for, even with the news he'd delivered. Aelin decided she didn't particularly give a shit who was watching, and rose up on her toes to brush her mouth against his. It had taken all her wits and abilities to avoid leaving traces of her scent today for him to detect, and the shocked delight on his face had been utterly worth it. Rowan's hand on her arm tightened as she pulled away.
"The feeling, Prince," she murmured, "is mutual."
The others were doing their best not to watch them, save for Rolf, who was still seething.
"Oh, don't look so put out, Captain," she said, turning away from Rowan and sliding into a seat across from Rolf. "You hate me, I hate you. We both hate being told what to do by busybody overlording empires. It's a perfect pairing."
Rolf spat.
"You nearly wrecked everything I've worked for.
Your silver tongue and arrogance won't get you through this." Just for the hell of it, she smiled and stuck out her tongue. Not the real thing, but a forked tongue of silver fire that wriggled like a snake's in the air. Fenris choked on a dark laugh. She ignored him. She'd deal with their presence later. She just prayed she'd be able to warn Adian before he ran into his father, who was now sitting two seats down from her, gawking at her as if she had 10 heads.
Gods. Even the expression was like Adian's. How hadn't she noticed that this spring in Wendlin?
Adian had been a boy the last time she'd seen him. But as a man. With Gavriel's immortality, they even looked the same age. Different in many ways. But that look. It was a reflection. Rolf wasn't smiling.
"A queen who plays with fire is not one who makes a solid ally."
"And a pirate whose men abandoned him at the first test of allegiance makes for a shit naval commander. Yet here I am, at this table."
"Careful, girl. You need me more than I need you."
"Do I?" A dance. That was all this was. Long before she'd set foot on this horrible island, it had been a dance, and she was now to enter into its second movement. She set Murtaugh's sealed letter of recommendation on the table between them.
"The way I see it, I have the gold, and I have the ability to raise you up from a common criminal to a respectable, established businessman.
Fenharrow can dispute who owns these islands. But what if I were to throw my support behind you? What if I were to make you not a pirate lord, but a pirate king?"
"And who would verify the word of a 19-year-old princess?"
She jerked her chin at the wax-sealed tube. Murtaugh Alsbrook would. He wrote you a nice long letter about it.
Rolf picked up the tube, studied it, and chucked it in a neat arc, right into his rubbish bin. The thud echoed through the office.
And I would, Dorian said,
leaning forward before Aelin could snarl at the ignored letter.
We win this war, and you have the two largest kingdoms on this continent proclaiming you the undisputed king of all pirates. Skulls Bay and the Dead Islands become not a hideout for your people, but a proper home, a new kingdom.
Rolf let out a low laugh.
The talk of young idealists and dreamers.
The world, Aelin said, will be saved and remade by the dreamers, Rolf.
The world will be saved by the warriors, by the men and women who will spill their blood for it, not for empty promises and gilded dreams.
Aelin laid her hands flat on the table. Perhaps. But if we win this war, it will be a new world. A free world. That is my promise. To you. To anyone who will march under my banner. A better world. And you will have to decide where your place in it shall be.
That is the promise of a little girl who still doesn't know how the world truly works,
Rolf said. Masters are needed to maintain order, to keep things running and profitable. It will not end well for those who seek to upend it.
Aelin purred. Do you want gold, Rolf? Do you want a title? Do you want glory or women or land? Or is it just the bloodlust that drives you?
She gave a pointed glance at his gloved hands. What was the cost for the map? What was the end goal if that sacrifice had to be made?
There is nothing you can offer or say, Aelin Galathinius, that I cannot attain myself.
A sly smile.
Unless you plan to offer me your hand and make me king of your territory, which might be an interesting proposition.
Bastard. Self-serving, awful bastard. He'd seen her with Rowan. He was drinking in the stillness with which both of them now sat, the death in Rowan's eyes.
Looks like you bit on the wrong horse,
Rolf crooned. He flicked his eyes to Dorian.
What news did you receive?
But that wrong horse cut in smoothly.
There was none. But you'll be glad to know your spies at the Ocean Rose are certainly doing their job, and that His Majesty is quite an accomplished actor.
Aelin held in her laugh. Rolf's face darkened.
Get out of my office.
Dorian said coldly,
For a petty grudge, you'd refuse to consider allying with us?
Aelin snorted. I'd hardly call wrecking his shit poor city and ships a petty grudge.
You have 2 days to get yourselves off this island,
Rolf said, teeth flashing. After that, my promise from 2.5 years ago still holds. A sneer at her companions.
Take your menagerie with you.
Smoke curled in her mouth. She had expected debate, but it was time to regroup. Time to see what Rowan and Dorian had done and plan out the next steps. Let Rolf think she was leaving the dance unfinished for now. Aelin hit the narrow hallway, a wall of muscle at her back and by her side, and faced another dilemma. Adian. He was loitering outside the inn to monitor for any unfriendly forces. If she stormed right to him, she'd bring him face to face with his long-lost, completely oblivious father. Aelin made it all of 3 steps down the hall when Gabriel said behind her,
Where is he?
Slowly, she looked back. The warrior's tan face was tight, his eyes full of sorrow and steel. She smirked.
If you are referring to sweet darling Lorkin...
You know who I'm referring to.
Rowan took a step between them, but his harsh face yielded nothing. Fenris slipped into the hall, shutting Rolf's office door, and monitored them with dark amusement. Oh, Rowan had told her lots about him. A face and body men and women would kill to possess. What Maeve made him do. What he'd given for his twin. But Aelin sucked on a tooth and said to Gavriel, Isn't the better question, who is he? Gavriel didn't smile. Didn't move. Buy herself time. Buy Adian time. You don't get to decide when and where and how you meet him, Aelin said.
He's my god's damned son. I think I do.
Aelin shrugged. You don't even get to decide if you're allowed to call him that. Those tawny eyes flashed, the tattooed hands curled into fists. But Rowan said,
Gavriel, she does not intend to keep you from him. Tell me where my son is. Now.
Ah, there it was. The face of the lion. The warrior who had felled armies, whose reputation made wintered soldiers shudder, whose fallen warriors were tattooed all over him. But Aelin picked at her nails, then frowned at the now empty hall behind her. Hell if I know where he's gone off to. They blinked, then started, as they beheld where Lysandra had once been, to where she had now vanished, flying or slithering or crawling out of the open window, to get Adian away. Aelin just said to Gavriel, her voice flat and cold, Don't ever give me orders. Adian and Lysandra were already waiting at the Ocean Rose, and as they entered the pretty courtyard, Aelin barely dragged up the energy to remark to Rowan that she was shocked he hadn't opted for warrior squalor. Dorian, a few steps behind, laughed quietly, which was good, she supposed. Good that he was laughing. He had not been the last time she saw him, and it had been weeks since she'd laughed herself. Felt that weight lift long enough to do so. She gave Rowan a look that told him to meet her upstairs and halted halfway across the courtyard. Dorian, sensing her intent, paused as well. The evening air was heavy with sweet fruit and climbing flowers, the fountain in the center gurgling softly. She wondered if the owner of the inn hailed from the Red Desert, if they'd seen the use of water and stone and greenery at the Keep of the Silent Assassins. But Aelin murmured to Dorian, I'm sorry about Rifthold. The king's summer-tanned face tightened.
Thank you for the help.
Aelin shrugged. Rowan's always looking for an excuse to show off. Dramatic rescues give him purpose and fulfillment in his dull, immortal life. There was a pointed cough from the open balcony doors above them, sharp enough to inform her that Rowan had heard and wouldn't forget that little quip when they were alone. She held in her smile. It had been a surprise and a delight, she supposed, that an easy, respectful calm flowed between Rowan and Dorian on their walk over here. She motioned for the king to continue with her, and said quietly, well aware of how many spies Rolf employed within the building. It seems you and I are currently without crowns, thanks to a few bullshit pieces of paper. Dorian didn't return her smile. The stairs groaned beneath them as they headed for the second floor. They were almost to the room Dorian had indicated when he said,
Maybe that's a good thing.
She opened and closed her mouth, and opted, for once, to keep quiet, shaking her head a bit as she entered the chamber.
Their meeting was hushed, thorough. Rowan and Dorian laid out in precise detail what had happened to them, Adian pushing for counts of the witches, their armor, how they flew, what formations they used. Anything to feed to the Bane, to amplify their northern defenses, regardless of who commanded them. The General of the North, who would take all those pieces and build their resistance. But the sheer ease with which the Iron Teeth Legion had taken the city.
Manon Blackbeak, Adian mused, would be a valuable ally if we can get her to turn.
Aelin glanced at Rowan's shoulder, where a faint scar now marred the golden skin beneath his clothes. Perhaps getting Manon to turn on her kin would ignite an internal battle among the witches, she said. Maybe they'll save us the task of killing them and just destroy each other. Dorian straightened in his chair, but only cold calculations swirled in his eyes as he countered.
But what is it that they want? Beyond our heads, I mean. Why ally with Erewhon at all?
And all of them then looked to the thin necklace of scars marring the base of Aelin's throat, where the scent permanently marked her as a witch killer. Baba Yellowlegs had visited the castle this winter for that alliance, but had there been anything else? We can contemplate the whys and hows of it later, Aelin declared. If we encounter any of the witches, we take them alive. I want some questions answered. Then she explained what they'd witnessed in Ilium, the order Brannan had given her. Find the lock. Well, he and his little quest could get in line. It was never-ending, she supposed, while they dined that night on peppered crab and spiced rice. This burden, these threats. Erewhon had been planning this for decades. Maybe for centuries, while he'd slept, he'd planned all this out. And she was to be given nothing more than obscure commands by long-dead royals to find a way to stop it. Nothing more than God's damned months to rally a force against him. She doubted it was a coincidence that Maeve was sailing for Eelway at the same moment Brannan had commanded she go to the Stone Marshes on its southwestern peninsula. Or that the God's damned Morath fleet was squatting in the Gulf of Oro, right on its other side. There was not enough time. Not enough time to do what she needed to fix things. But small steps. She had Rolf to deal with, the little matter of securing his people's alliance, and the map she still needed to persuade him to use, to assist her in tracking down that lock. But first, best to ensure that infernal map actually worked. Chapter 29 Too many animals loitering about the streets at this hour would attract the wrong sort of attention. But Adian still wished that the shifter was wearing fur or feathers compared to this. Not that she was sore on the eyes as an auburn-haired and green-eyed young woman. She could have passed for one of the lovely mountain maidens of Northern Terrasen with that coloring. It was who Lysandra was supposed to be, as they waited just inside an alley. Who he was supposed to be, too. Lysandra leaned against the brick wall, a foot propped against it to reveal a length of creamy white thigh, and Adian, with his hand braced against the wall beside her head, was no more than an hourly customer. No sound in the alley but scuttling rats digging through rotten, discarded fruit. Skull's Bay was precisely the shithole he expected it to be, right down to its pirate lord, who now unwittingly held the only map to the lock that Aelin had been commanded to find. When Adian had complained that, of course, it was a map they could not steal, Rowan had been the one to suggest this plan, trap, whatever it was. He glanced at the delicate gold chain dangling around Lysandra's pale throat, tracing its length down the front of her bodice, to where the amulet of Orinth was now hidden beneath.
Admiring the view?
Adian snapped his eyes up from the generous swells of her breasts.
Sorry.
But the shifter somehow saw the thoughts churning in his head.
You think this won't work?
I think there are plenty of valuable things on this island. Why would Rolf bother to go after this?
Storms, enemies, and treasure. That was what the map showed. And since he and Lysandra were not the first two, only one, it seemed, would be able to appear on that map inked on Rolf's hands.
Rowan claimed Rolf would find the amulet interesting enough to go after it.
Rowan and Aelin have a tendency to say one thing and mean something else entirely. Adian heaved a breath through his nose.
We've already been here an hour.
She arched an auburn brow.
Do you have somewhere else to be?
You're tired.
We're all tired, she said sharply.
He shut his mouth, not wanting his head ripped off just yet. Each shift took something out of Lysandra. The bigger the change, the bigger the animal, the steeper the cost. Adian had witnessed her morph from butterfly to bumblebee to hummingbird to bat within the span of a few minutes. But going from human to ghost leopard to bear or elk or horse, she'd once demonstrated, took longer between shifts, the magic having to draw up the strength to become that size, to fill the body with all its inherent power. Casual footsteps sounded, accented by a two-note whistle. Lysandra's breath brushed against his jaw at the sound. Adian, however, stiffened slightly as those steps grew closer, and he found himself staring at the son of his great enemy, King now. But still a face he'd hated, sneered at, debated cutting into tiny pieces for many, many years. A face he'd seen drunk out of his mind at parties mere seasons ago. A face he'd seen buried against the necks of women whose names he'd never bothered to learn. A face that had taunted him in that dungeon cell. That face was now hooded. And for all the world, he looked like he was here to inquire about Lysandra's services, once Adian had finished with her. The general clenched his teeth.
What?
Dorian looked over Lysandra, as if surveying the goods, and Adian fought the urge to bristle.
Rowan sent me to see if you had any developments.
The prince and Aelin were back at the inn, drinking in the dining room, where all of Rolf's spying eyes might see and report them. Dorian blinked at the shifter, starting.
And gods above, you really can take on any human form.
Lysandra shrugged, the irreverent street whore debating her rate.
It's not as interesting as you'd think. I'd like to see if I could become a plant, or a bit of wind.
Can you do that?
Of course she can, Adian said, pushing off the wall and crossing his arms.
No,
Lysandra said, cutting a glare in Adian's direction.
And there's nothing to report. Not even a whiff of Rolf or his men.
Dorian nodded, sliding his hands into his pockets.
Silence.
Adian's ankle barked in pain as Lysandra subtly kicked him. He reined in his scowl as he said to the king,
So, you and Whitethorn didn't kill each other.
Dorian's brows scrunched.
He saved my life. Nearly got himself burned out to do it. Why should I be anything but grateful?
Lysandra gave Adian a smug smile. But the king asked him,
Are you going to see your father?
Adian cringed. He'd been glad for their venture tonight to avoid deciding. Aelin hadn't brought it up, and he had been content to come out here, even if it put him at risk of running into the male.
Of course I'll see him,
Adian said tightly. Lysandra's moon-white face was calm, steady as she watched him, the face of a woman trained to listen to men, to never show surprise. He did not resent what she had been, what she portrayed now, only the monsters who had seen the beauty the child would grow into and taken her into that brothel. Aelin had told him what Erebin had done to the man she'd loved. It was a miracle the shifter could smile at all. Adian jerked his chin at Dorian.
Go tell Aelin and Rowan we don't need their hovering. We can manage on our own.
Dorian stiffened, but backed down the alley, no more than a disgruntled would-be customer. Lysandra shoved a hand against Adian's chest and hissed,
That man has endured enough, Adian. A little kindness wouldn't kill you.
He stabbed Aelin. If you knew him as I have, you wouldn't be so willing to fawn over—
No one expects you to fawn over him, but a kind word, some respect—
He rolled his eyes.
Keep your voice down.
She did, but went on.
He was enslaved. He was tortured for months, not just by his father, but by that thing inside of him. He was violated, and even if you cannot draw up forgiveness for stabbing Aelin against his own will, then try to have some compassion for that.
Adian's heart stuttered at the anger and pain on her face, and that word she'd used. He swallowed hard, checking the street behind them. No sign of anyone hunting for the treasure they bore.
I knew Dorian as a reckless, arrogant—
I knew your queen as the same. We were children then. We are allowed to make mistakes, to figure out who we wish to be. If you will allow Aelin the gift of your acceptance—
I don't care if he was as arrogant and vain as Aelin. I don't care if he was enslaved to a demon that took his mind. I look at him and see my family butchered, see those tracks to the river, and hear Quinn tell me that Aelin was drowned and dead.
His breathing was uneven, and his throat burned, but he ignored it. Lysandra said,
Aelin forgave him. Aelin never once held it against him.
Adian snarled at her. Lysandra snarled right back and held his stare with the face not trained or built for bedrooms, but the true one beneath. Wild and unbroken and indomitable. No matter what body she wore, she was the Staghorn's given form, the heart of Oakwald. Adian said hoarsely,
I'll try.
Try harder. Try better.
Adian braced his palm against the wall again and leaned in to glower in her face. She did not yield an inch.
There is an order and rank in our court, lady. And last I checked, you were not number 3. You don't give me commands.
This isn't a battlefield, Lysandra hissed. Any ranks are formalities. And the last I checked?
She poked his chest. Right between his pectorals, and he could have sworn the tip of a claw pierced the skin beneath his clothes.
You weren't pathetic enough to enforce rank to hide from being in the wrong.
His blood sparked and thrummed. Adian found himself taking in the sensuous curves of her mouth, now pressed thin with anger. The hot temper in her eyes faded. And as she retracted her finger as if she'd been burned, he froze at the panic that filled her features instead.
Shit. Shit.
Lysandra backed away a step, too casual to be anything but a calculated move. But Adian tried. For her sake, he tried to stop thinking about her mouth.
You truly want to meet your father?
She asked calmly. Too calmly. He nodded, swallowing hard. Too soon.
She wouldn't want a man's touch for a long time. Maybe forever. And he'd be damned if he pushed her into it before she wanted to. And gods above, if Lysandra ever looked at any man with interest like that, he'd be glad for her. Glad she was choosing for herself, even if it wasn't him she picked. Adian swallowed, forcing himself to remember what she'd asked. His father, right.
Did he want to see me?
Was all he could think to ask. She cocked her head to the side, the movement so feline he wondered if she was spending too much time in that ghost leopard's fur.
He nearly bit Aelin's head off when she refused to tell him where and who you are.
Ice filled his veins. If his father had been rude to her.
But I got the sense,
Lysandra quickly clarified as he tensed,
that he is the sort of male who would respect your wishes if you chose not to see him. Yet in this small town, with the company we're keeping, that might prove impossible.
Did you also get the sense that it could persuade him to help us? Knowing me?
I don't think Aelin would ever ask that of you,
Lysandra said, laying a hand on the arm still braced beside her head.
What do I even say to him?
Adian murmured.
I've heard so many stories about him. The Lion of Dorinel. He's a goddamned white knight. I don't think he'll approve of a son most people call Otterlin's whore.
She clicked her tongue, but Adian pinned her with a look.
What would you do?
I can't answer that question. My own father.
She shook her head. He knew about that. The shifter father who had either abandoned her mother or not even known she was pregnant. And then the mother who had thrown Lysandra into the street when she discovered her heritage.
Adian, what do you want to do? Not for us, not for Terrison, but for you.
He bowed his head a bit, glancing sidelong at the quiet street again.
My whole life has been not about what I want. I don't know how to choose those things.
No.
From the moment he'd arrived in Terrison at age 5, he'd been trained, his path chosen. And when Terrison had burned beneath Otterland's touches, another hand had gripped the leash of his fate. Even now, with war upon them, had he truly never wanted something for himself? All he'd wanted had been the blood oath, and Aelin had given that away to Rowan. He didn't resent her for it, not anymore, but he had not realized he had asked for so little. Lysandra said quietly,
I know. I know what that feels like.
He lifted his head, finding her green eyes again in the darkness. He sometimes wished Arabin Hommel were still alive, just so he could kill the Assassin King himself.
Tomorrow morning, he murmured. Will you come with me? To see him?
She was quiet for a moment before she said, You really want me to go with you?
He did. He couldn't explain why, but he wanted her there. She got under his skin so damn easily, but Lysandra steadied him. Perhaps because she was something new, something he had not encountered, had not filled with hope and pain and wishes. Not too many of them, at least.
If you wouldn't mind. Yes. I want you there.
She didn't respond. He opened his mouth, but steps sounded. Light. Too casual. They ducked deeper into the shadows of the alley, its dead-end wall looming behind them. If this went poorly, If it went poorly, he had a shapeshifter capable of shredding apart droves of men at his side. Adian flashed Lysandra a grin as he leaned over her once more, his nose within grazing distance of her neck. Those steps neared, and Lysandra loosed a breath, her body going pliant. From the shadows of his hood, he monitored the alley ahead, the shadows and shafts of moonlight, bracing himself. They'd picked the dead-end alley for a reason. The girl realized her mistake a step too late. Oh. Adian looked up, his own features hidden within his hood. As Lysandra purred to the young woman who perfectly matched Rowan's description of Rolf's barmaid.
I'll be done in 2 minutes, if you want to wait your turn.
Color stained the girl's cheeks, but she gave them a flinty look, scanning them from head to toe.
Wrong turn, she said. You sure?
Lysandra crooned.
A bit late in the evening for a stroll.
Rolf's barmaid fixed them with that sharp stare and sauntered back down the street. They waited. 1 minute. 5. 10. No others came. Adian at last pulled away, Lysandra now watching the alley entrance. The shifter wound an auburn curl around her finger.
She seems an unlikely thief.
Some would say similar things about you and Aelin. Lysandra hummed in agreement. Adian mused. Perhaps she was just a scout. Rolf's eyes.
Why bother? Why not just come take the thing?
Adian glanced again at the amulet that disappeared beneath Lysandra's bodice. Maybe she thought she was looking for something else.
Lysandra, wisely, didn't fish the amulet of Orinth out from her dress.
But his words hung between them, as they carefully picked their way back to the Ocean Rose. Chapter 30. After 2 weeks of inching across the muddy open plains, Elid was tired of using her mother's name. Tired of constantly being on alert to hear it barked by Molly to clean up after every meal. A mistake, no doubt, to have ever told the woman she had some experience washing dishes in busy kitchens. Tired of hearing Ombriel, the dark-haired beauty, not a carnival act at all, but Molly's niece and their moneykeeper, use it when questioning about how she'd hurt her leg, where her family came from, and how she'd learned to observe others so keenly that she could turn a coin as an oracle. At least Lorkin barely used it, as they'd hardly spoken while the caravan trudged through the mud-laden fields. The ground was so saturated with the daily afternoon summer rain that the wagons often became stuck. They'd barely covered any distance at all. And when Ombriel would catch Elid gazing northward, she'd ask, yet another recurring question, what lay in the north to draw her attention so frequently? Elid always lied, always evaded. The sleeping situation between Elid and her husband, fortunately, was more easily avoided. With the sodden earth, sleeping on it was nearly impossible. So the women laid out wherever they could in the two wagons, leaving the men to draw straws each night for who would get any remaining space, and who would sleep on the ground atop a makeshift floor of reeds. Lorkin, somehow, always got the short straw, either by his own devices, sleight of hand from Nick, who ran security and the nightly straw drawing, or simply from sheer bad luck. But at least it kept Lorkin far, far away from her, and kept their interactions to a minimum. Those few conversations they'd had, held when he escorted her to draw water from a swollen stream or gather whatever firewood could be found on the plain, weren't much to bother her either. He pressed her for more details regarding Morath, more information about the guards' clothes, the armies camped around it, the servants and witches. She'd started at the top of the keep,
with the Aries and Wyverns and witches. Then she'd descended, floor by floor. It had taken them these 2 weeks to work their way down to the sublevels, and their companions had no idea that while the young married couple snuck off for more firewood, whispering sweet nothings was the last thing on their minds. When the caravan stopped that night, Elide aimed for a copse of trees in the heart of the field to see what could be used at their large